Call the meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we have a very packed agenda today, so we're going to get started, and then we'll take a break to take care of our formal business once we do have a quorum. Because we don't have a quorum, we won't make the motions right now, but we will start to take a look at our sole item of our agenda, which is House File 5. And I would recognize Chair Lori Halverson at this time to present her bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to present House File 5. It's a bill that is about healthy families, healthy babies, care for our aging population, and creating a healthy and dynamic workforce for the state of Minnesota. House File 5 is about creating paid family medical leave for the people of Minnesota, both workers and their employers. We know that about 14% of people in the United States are the lucky ones who have access to paid family and medical leave through their employers. And Minnesota employers have taken the lead nationwide in terms of providing these benefits. We know that companies like Target provide paid family medical leave benefits from their C-suite down to the folks that we see working on the floor at our local Target stores. We know that General Mills is offering benefits and has extended more benefits to their employees over the years. And these are just a couple examples. At the same time, we hear from small businesses who are looking to compete in the marketplace for workers. Workers are harder to come by every single day, and we hear at these committees on a regular basis about the shortages that employers are facing in the workforce. And so making sure that people have a way to get into the workforce and stay up in the workforce is important. And small employers want to compete for the best and the brightest, just like our large employers are able to do. This is also an economic benefit for the people of Minnesota. It's an economic benefit for employers. That's why those who have the economy of scale have rolled these types of benefits out. We know that paid family leave leads to healthier pregnancies. The costs of complications from pregnancies are incredibly expensive in our healthcare system, and we hear every day about how we're going to get our healthcare costs under control. We also hear about the shortage in childcare and the expense of childcare for families. And paid family leave allows parents to take the time without losing a paycheck to stay at home and care for a new baby or a baby that's new to your family through adoption. It also is really good for childhood brain development, another thing we're talking about a lot at the Capitol this year. How are we ensuring that children 0 to 3 have the resources available to them and the care available to them so that they can benefit from brain development that happens when you're bonding with your child? As much as we love our time with our new babies, looking into their eyes and staring at them, I used to call it baby TV. It's like I never knew I could stare at another human being so long. But there actually is science that says that time, that skin-to-skin time, that eye-to-eye time, has significant impacts on developing brains. And those impacts, those positive impacts, have a direct impact on our state budgets because these are issues that we're trying to solve. We also know that it helps people enter and stay into the workforce. One of the most dramatic things I've heard as I've been carrying this bill is a woman who owns a small business. She's the only employee of her business. She said to me, boy, if I had the access to paid leave, I would be able to take leave to have a child. That is dramatic. People are putting off life decisions based on the fact of whether or not they can forego a paycheck. We knew far too many Minnesotans live on the razor's edge of the economy. They're one illness, one family illness, one complicated pregnancy away from true economic disaster. These are daily problems that Minnesotans are facing, and none of us are immune to it. Those of us who aren't bringing new babies into the world probably are facing the issue of aging parents. younger families are making decisions about when to start their families. And work plays into all of these decisions for Minnesotans. In order for Minnesota to have a thriving future, we need to be sure that we have a thriving and healthy workforce, and paid family leave helps us get there. It's been 25 years since the Federal Family Medical Leave Act passed. Think about that, 25 years. Where were you 25 years ago? At the time, it was revolutionary. But the fact is paid family leave does not protect Minnesota workers like it needs to because it is unpaid leave. I know of almost no families that can go without a paycheck. I want you to think about your own families and think about how many paychecks you can lose. And the fact is people make the choice to lose a paycheck to take care of their parents, to hold the hand of a family member who is in hospice, to take care of themselves when they are in a high-risk pregnancy, and to stay home with their new baby. It's time for Minnesota and the rest of the country, frankly, to join the rest of the world. The United States joins Papua New Guinea as the only countries without paid family medical leave programs. This is an idea whose time has come, and I look forward to hearing from the members of the public who have come here to testify about this bill. Couple things. When we get a quorum, we can move the bill and move the author's amendment. You can tell me when that is, Mr. Chair. The author's amendment reflects the beginning of some very serious work on this bill. I have committed to having an open door policy. Amy can attest to the fact that I have a lot of meetings about this particular issue. And we really want feedback because we understand that this is a policy that can work for businesses and work for Minnesota workers. And we're going to put a bill together that works for Minnesota. This will not be the only amendment we will see on this bill. And I look forward to more feedback. I see that there are a number of members of the public who have signed up to testify, and I think it's important that we hear from the public about the impacts of this bill, hear concerns about the bill, hear support for the bill. And so, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I think that we can take public testimony before questions and then decide as a committee what to do. We do have this room for the evening, and we can come back and debate as a committee, but I think we want to respect the members of the public who took the time to be here. So. That is all, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Chair Halverson, and we do now have a quorum present. I think first, if we could tackle the minutes from our February 13th, 2019 meeting.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lislegard. And is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from February 13th, 2019 meeting, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. That motion prevails. And Chair Halverson, I don't know if you want to make a motion to bring your bill formally before the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 5.
All right, Chair Halverson moves House File 5, and then I understand you have an author's amendment that you just... Oh, and that would be to be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee?
Yes, re-referred to Government Operations.
And I understand you have an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment. I'd like to move the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
All right. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. And now I believe we have some testifiers on the author's behalf.
And Mr. Chair...
Yes, Chair Halverson.
If you'd like, I could just very briefly give a few highlights of the A4 amendment. We put this forward as a kind of a chapter and verse amendment so that people could see where we're making some changes. But I do want to say that a lot of this came from feedback from outside folks. So I just want you to note a couple of key things, including the fact that we changed the effective date of when we would start collecting premiums in the program. And when workers could start applying for benefits. Premiums would be collected starting January 1st, 2021, and we would start the program January 1st, 2022 in order to create solvency within the program. We do tie this to UI, And so unemployment insurance, and so that is the model for the bill. We give DEED some flexibility in how they stand up the program technologically. We did consult with both DEED and DALI to try to create as many definitions as possible that are currently in line, that our employers are currently functioning under, so that we're not trying to ask people to play under different rules. And so we model a lot of the definitions under underpaid family leave. We also change the exclusion. We allow employers who are large employers, usually, who have a robust paid family medical leave in place, who want to keep that program, to do so. And they can have a private program. They just have to apply to DEED with what their program is. And we also change the way that they would not have to pay a premium going forward. They would pay a one-time surcharge for the administration of the exemption. So those are just a few highlights. Mr. Weeks is here and can provide more detail as we move on in our member discussion, but I'm happy to move on to member testimony right now.
Thank you, Chair Halverson, and I think the first testifier we have on our list is Corinne Horowitz.
Yes, Corinne, thank you. Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, my name is Corinne Horowitz. I'm with the Main Street Alliance of Minnesota. We're an advocacy network of hundreds of businesses across Minnesota, and we're proud to be here on behalf of the Minnesotans for Paid Family and Medical Leave, a broad coalition made up of nearly 30 organizations representing labor, faith, and community organizations. Together, we have a combined reach of about 1 million Minnesotans. Main Street Alliance is part of the Minnesotans for Paid Family Medical Leave Coalition because small businesses want and need paid family medical leave insurance. The lack of an inclusive, affordable, accessible system is an enormous problem and huge burden for small businesses and self-employed people across the state who want to be able to provide benefits to their employees but simply cannot afford it, who want to themselves have babies and care for themselves and their loved ones but are not able to, and entrepreneurs who want to start businesses but are tied to corporate careers due to lack of benefits. By creating an employee and employer-funded paid family medical leave insurance program with a modest shared premium, we can level the playing field for these small businesses and start to solve this crisis. This program already exists in six states and in D.C. In New Jersey, California, and Rhode Island, the vast majority of employers reported that paid family medical leave had a positive or no noticeable effect on productivity, profitability, turnover, or morale. While a vast majority of small businesses support paid leave, only 15% are able to offer it to their employees. Small businesses want to be part of the solution, both to support their employees and to level the playing field with large corporations. That's why our nationwide survey on the issue, including hundreds of Minnesota businesses and greater Minnesota businesses, it showed widespread support for paid leave, with 64%, including 78% of women and businesses of color supporting it. We have worked with the coalition for a long time to make this happen, and it's long overdue. Our small businesses and families can't wait. Everyone in this room has a story. I have my own story of using paid leave after the birth of my first biological child and during a family crisis as a foster parent. But I want you to hear from our small business owners and their employees today, who they themselves have families to care for and want an employee who they want to see live full lives. Today, you will also hear arguments that this will hurt small businesses' bottom lines. That is simply not true. Small businesses are looking to the state for innovative solutions, not fear-based arguments rooted in scarcity and based in ideological opposition. The truth is, we can do it. Our state is blessed with enormous resources and talents. In fact, we can't afford not to do it. Our current system is costly to small businesses, to workers, to families, and the economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I believe the next person on the testifying list is Commissioner Grove of the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I'm thrilled to be here on behalf of the governor and lieutenant governor, who, as you saw just a few hours ago, released their budget plan for this year. And paid family leave was a part of that plan. We've been working hand-in-hand with Representative Halverson and other advocates and experts in the community to put together a package in this space. As you saw from the campaign trail, the governor and lieutenant governor campaigned on this issue extensively. It was a part of their message from start to finish and something that they really truly believe in. As you'll see in the details of the governor's budget, the ask that we've made thus far is for the basic setup costs to get DEED in a place where we could administer such a program. The price tag on that is about $68 million. That creates a collection system, an online interface, a benefits payment system, and then the staffing to collect those taxes in the first year. We are modeling the program on the UI benefits program such that it would be an insurance program for which taxes would pay for in the future, of course, but in that first year, we've got to ramp up to be able to begin the program, and the cost of that is about $68 million. I should say that that includes both DEED's costs, but then also some costs from Dolly and the health department to make sure that we're in a good place to run the program. We're excited about this. It's a big idea, and I think it puts Minnesota on the forefront of states who are really thinking critically about how to make our economy work for everyone. Obviously, it takes care of the people that need the help the most, the little babies, people who are injured, those who are sick. That's, I think, the sort of the moral issue at play. But coming from a deep perspective, thinking about competitiveness in the business landscape, we really see this as a great driver of a growing economy. And when you look at one of the biggest issues our state's economy faces today, which is our talent gap, you know, you've got 140,000 open jobs in the state and about 80,000 unemployed workers. We don't even have enough unemployed workers to take our open jobs. A big part of that is demographics, but there's also a labor participation issue. And when you start looking at the data, we've seen decreases in labor participation from 25 to 34-year-olds in our labor market. And part of that, as the representative said earlier, has to do with women or men who are not incentivized to get into the labor force because they need to take care of their young children or an aging or sick family member. So we think this will help them do that, get them back in the labor force, and it will be a piece of a broader strategy to tackle our talent gap in the state. And then lastly, I think this is about helping small businesses and companies that can't create programs like this on their own find a way to do it. Before I came into government, I worked at Google and had a great family leave policy. My wife and I had twins 2 years ago. Everyone in this room has their story of ways in which they've tried to take care of young babies with leave policies, and I was lucky to work at a company that had a generous one. It was a big company, and it was a wealthy company. Smaller businesses will struggle to do this unless we find a way to help them do it through a program like this. I think the details will be worked out in the coming weeks and months. We look forward to meeting with small businesses across the state to figure out exactly how to arrange this program and the types of benefits and the lengths of benefits. But for now, we just wanted to signal that we are on board with this legislation. We're excited about it. We think we've got a really good estimate of what it would take to start it up. I can't wait to work with members of this committee and the rest of the legislature to make it happen. So thanks for having me here today. The governor and lieutenant governor are really excited about this and thrilled to work with all of you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And our next... I'm sure the commissioner will stay around if we ask him to.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I'm available for later for questions.
Yeah, sure.
Terrific. Commissioner Nancy Lepik is next.
So I will echo what my colleague and fellow commissioner has just said regarding the importance of this legislation to the prosperity of Minnesota families and Minnesota businesses. That we all know and we all get talked about this idea of work-life balance. Well, for most of us, work-life balance is a struggle every day. But when the unexpected happens, it suddenly becomes an impossibility. And so consequently, for Minnesota workers and their families, a foundational piece of legislation like this is critical to even having a hope of finding that balance. And the same is true for Minnesota businesses, because just as families cannot predict when the unexpected is going to happen, businesses are in the same have the same challenge and the same need to balance their workforce needs with the balance of the needs to balance with the needs of their workers. And so consequently, this is foundational. This is along the lines of Social Security, along the lines of Medicare, where we are all contributing to further that very foundational piece of progressions of life. And this is one when that's critical in the context of where people are working. And this is a critical need for people to fully engage in the workforce, but also for businesses to have predictability in how they operate their businesses. So as the governor and the lieutenant governor have indicated for months now, that this is a key component of their community prosperity agenda. It's clearly set out as a priority in their budget, and Commissioner Grove and I are fully committed to working with Representative Halverson to ensure that this legislation fulfills expectations and is something that can be achieved for Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner. The next step in this process is to open up for public testimony. We will return to member questions at the end of the public testimony. I want to let everybody in the room know that we've had 20 people sign up to testify, and it is right now about 5 minutes to 3 o'clock. We do have the room reserved into the evening, and so we can stay as long as necessary. But we obviously want to make sure that particularly members of the public who signed up to testify during our hearing have the opportunity to do so. So we ask everyone to work cooperatively towards that goal by trying to limit your remarks to 2.5 or 3 minutes in length. Our committee administrator, who's seated to my right, will wave at the person testifying at about 2 minutes into their testimony to let them know about where they are. But if we can work cooperatively on this to get done, that would be much appreciated. I will always try to indicate who the next person to testify is so you know that you're sort of on deck. So our first member of the public who signed up to testify is Paul Eager. You come forward to testify, and after Mr. Eager is Nancy Lyons. Thank you, Mr. Eager. If you could state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Eager. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors. We are a trade association with 20,000 real estate professionals throughout Minnesota as our membership. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding our concerns with House File 5. I'd also like to thank Chair Halverson for taking the time to meet with us, and I look forward to continuing the dialogue as this bill moves forward. Mr. Chair, House File 5 mandates that covered business entities and the self-employed individuals with income earned from a covered business entity participate in the paid family leave program. Most licensed real estate salespersons in Minnesota are self-employed independent contractors, not employees. This means a real estate salesperson has a written independent contractor agreement, sets his or her own work schedule and work location, chooses how to do his or her work, does not have set clients, pays for his or her own licensing, incurs and covers his or her costs of doing business, is paid on performance, and is subject to profit and loss just like any other small business. Yet House File 5 requires our self-employed independent contractor members to be treated as employees for the purposes of this bill. House File 5 would increase costs for our members, although the bill language does not yet include details regarding the premium rates. Also, the administrative costs associated with this bill for our members are unknown, but could be substantial. These additional costs would be a burden on our broker and salesperson members alike. Minnesota Realtors respectfully ask that you please remove mandates on covered business entities and self-employed individuals from House File 5 as this bill moves forward. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today and look forward to working with Chair Halverson as the bill progresses. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Hi, Chair Halverson.
If I just might respond to that testimony and just, you know, make sure that the realtors know, and I've heard from insurance agents as well, that we understand that there's a real variety of the way people work and earn money in Minnesota. And so I agree that the definition is challenging for this work population, and it's something that we'll continue to work with the stakeholders as well as the government to get definitions that are more appropriate for this particular work population. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next on the testimony is Nancy Lyons. After that will be Lauren Schothorst. Thank you, Ms. Lyons. If you could state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Nancy Lyons. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Nancy Lyons. I'm the CEO of Clockwork. We're a digital agency based in Minneapolis. We employ 60 people. My business partners and I started Clockwork 17 years ago in our basements. We were pretty intentional about what we wanted to build. We wanted to create the jobs and the workplace that we wanted. the kind of place where we always wanted to work, a culture that proved that the treatment of people matters. In those very early days, we made a commitment to put people first. That was and continues to be our business strategy. My employees know I care about them because I tell them every single day, but actions speak louder than words. I'm a business owner who offers some of what this legislation would offer, and I'm still for it. Why? Because while I invest as heavily as I can in our benefits package, I still can't compete with large companies and their rich benefits. With help like this legislation, I could improve my pool of benefits. For example, I could actually offer the leave that we currently offer and top off the salary so that no one is penalized at all when life happens. While I can never be General Mills or Target or 3M, I do have to compete with them every single day. Arguably, every employer in Minnesota is competing with them for talent in some way. The benefits they offer are what every person offers. I know this because people tell me when they quit to go to General Mills. I hear it from employees all the time. It's vital that businesses of all types and sizes keep up with what the workforce is demanding. Employees are demanding a work-life balance, or more than balance, they are asking for some amount of respect and awareness of their lives. When businesses do this, the businesses benefit. My company and I are living proof of that, and it's not easy. No one is giving my company a tax break simply for being in Minnesota. And yet, I employ 60 people, and I care for them and their families. People who get what they need from their employers give more back to those employers. If the government doesn't step in and help the small and medium-sized businesses, even companies like mine that manage to offer some paid leave, we won't be able to compete for talent in this marketplace. And as a woman and a mom and a business owner, my life boils down to two priorities, my family and my work, and I would hate to have to choose between them. I know I'm not alone, and I can't think of a better thing to offer my staff than a little peace of mind.
Thank you, Ms. Lyons. Next is Lauren Schothorst, and after that will be Lonnie Bassa. And if you could state your name and then proceed to your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schothorst, and I serve as the Labor and Management Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,300 employers and over 500,000 employees in every industry across the state. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses, but our members do include many of Minnesota's Fortune 500 headquartered companies. The things I have heard most from our members when discussing the state of Minnesota's economy and their business challenges are this: costs of doing business are too darn high in Minnesota, and employees are like family and their most valuable asset. Our companies are providing employees with innovative benefits to attract and retain the best talent in a competitive marketplace and provide time and space for employees to care for themselves and for their families while ensuring their businesses can perform, stay viable, or even grow. And our employers are doing this without a mandate and without having to comply with a specific state-dictated benefit and paperwork and reporting compliance mechanisms that add on additional costs and challenges to their operations. Our members share the goal of giving Minnesotans access to the time they need to care for themselves and their loved ones. But balancing employer and employee needs, program scope, and costs are also really important in achieving this goal. On a national scale, Minnesota is less competitive because public policies make our costs of doing business higher than in many other states. From taxes, top five, to electricity rates, 15th and 20th, to health insurance and workers' comp premiums, 31st and 22nd, it is becoming increasingly difficult to keep our Minnesota companies strong. We are here today because we are concerned that House File 5 imposes a new payroll tax on employers to create and fund a broad new state-administered insurance program at a time when we are experiencing a well-documented workforce shortage that is projected to get worse. First, we are concerned that our state would need to build this agency and infrastructure from scratch. This will be a very significant, complicated, lengthy, and expensive undertaking. The proposal also assumes that at least 7% of funds collected will be needed to run and staff the program annually. Conservatively, these costs will run in tens of millions of dollars. This bill creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for 24 weeks each year. That's 44% of a calendar year. In certain workplaces, such as hospitals or manufacturing facilities that run 24/7, extended leaves, as outlined in this bill, would compound already almost critical staffing shortages. Employers also rely on physical presence, particularly in small businesses, and expertise, skills, and institutional knowledge that simply cannot be replaced or put aside for almost half of the year at any given time. Employers today are already struggling to fill vacancies with qualified and ready individuals. I want to reiterate to the committee that employers consider their workforce one of the most essential and valuable parts of operating their businesses. That is why they work so hard to provide benefits and flexibility to retain trained, skilled employees. While we appreciate the goals of the proposal, we are concerned about the expansiveness of the benefit and how it's funded, and the challenges it presents in terms of managing the needs of individual workplaces, industries, and employers in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share our members' perspective on this legislation with the committee today.
Thank you very much. The next testifier is Lonnie Bassa, and after that will be Elizabeth Bengert. Please state your name and then proceed your testimony.
Lonnie Bassa. I'm the owner of the BWC, the Business Women's Circle. We're an organization that helps women grow their businesses through accountability, learning, and support in peer advisory groups. This year we're celebrating 10 years, and over that time we've probably served and mentored and supported over 400 women. Small businesses now account for 48% of all businesses in the U.S., and 4 out of every 10 businesses in the United States are women-owned. In 2018, the American Express State of Women-Owned Businesses Report ranked Minnesota number 1 in the employment vitality rankings, and they ranked the city of Minneapolis-St. Paul ranked number 2 in the same city rankings. And that's the good news. The flip side of that is that the SBA's 2018 small business profile for Minnesota shows that the number of startups and the jobs they generate per quarter is almost equal to the number of business exits and jobs lost for small businesses. There are many reasons why we see women-owned businesses fold, and I continue to hear from all of those women throughout my time. For example, with most caregiving still falling to women, paid leave is an important gender equity measure for business owners and employees alike. The stories I've heard range from a young entrepreneur who decided to shutter her business so she can go back to a corporate job where she would be able to get benefits to support her pregnancy and maternity leave. In addition, a business owner of 18 years who was very concerned about taking time off to move her parents, both of whom were impacted by dementia and health issues, up to Minnesota from Iowa because of the affordability that or the earnings she would lose during that time. And then recently, a startup business owner who had to have neck surgery for debilitating pain went back to work after 2 weeks because she could not afford to lose any more earnings. The state has an important role in promoting economic development, and this issue, along with health care, is an enormous problem for all businesses, but especially women-owned businesses. One of the keys to support them is in the form of policies like the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act. This act is an opportunity to help level the playing field and increase women's participation in the workforce. Most of us will need to provide care at some point in our life, either to welcome a new baby, care for an aging parent, or an unexpected health care crisis such as cancer. And it shouldn't be a financial struggle for any of us, whether we're a business owner or an employee. My hope is that HF5 will be a bill that shows the rest of the country how the state legislature, key stakeholders from small businesses to corporations, and constituents can come together to create something that supports not only the economic growth of the state, but the health and well-being of its people. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Elizabeth Bengert, and after that, Jessica Roloff. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
My name is Elizabeth Bengert, and I am the owner of a small, independently owned early childhood center in Mankato. President Reagan said the 9 most terrifying words you can ever hear are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." And in my industry, that is definitely true. The childcare crisis has been caused by overregulation in this state, so I have no control over my business when it comes to how parents pay, what food I serve, how many blocks I have. The one thing I have left is that the state somewhat trusts my intelligence level with having a master's degree to know what's best for my business. And apparently that's going out the window this session as well. I, as a private business owner, am regretting my decision to move from Illinois in 2003, barring how they handled my Second Amendment right there. And what we're doing is regulating businesses out of business. That's why people are exiting the state. So We also have House File 1 in 30, which expands how many parents can receive child care assistance in this state, and I'm wondering at what point we realize we can't pay for all the shiny things, because I don't have any money left to give, and I'm already being regulated out of business, and I'd actually prefer less government in my life rather than more, so I would strongly oppose this bill.
Thank you. The next testifier is Jessica Roloff. After that will be Stephanie Menning. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Hello, my name is Jessica Roloff, and I am a caregiver from rural Minnesota. I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee. Caregiving is a very emotional, intense, and private experience, and I want to thank you for honoring our stories. Yesterday, someone was living a fairly normal life with a regular routine. Maybe the call came in the middle of the night, or maybe it was their child who they brought to the doctor with a terrible headache, or their husband passed out briefly at work. For me, it was my grandmother who called in the middle of my work day. It became clear in the next few days that she was in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's disease. I didn't know it then, but I was about to take primary responsibility for her for the last 6 years of her life. Your constituents are trying to do the right thing, but we need your help. We need access to a system of comprehensive, intermittent, paid family leave. Caregiving is a marathon. It doesn't happen on a schedule, and it is not a sprint. We are the communication and transportation links between medical professionals. We spend hours in waiting rooms and surgery lounges. We assist in X-ray, lab, and treatment appointments. When it is needed, we sleep in the hospital. We prevent falls, IVs from being pulled out, and wounds from being pulled open. The medical system could never absorb the countless hours of unpaid care that family members provide. With this bill, we could weather the crisis and plan for another day. Many of us are women, and this situation impacts women of color even more. The examples I gave in the beginning of my testimony are all real people. My friend Monica got a call when her husband fainted at work. My neighbors took their child to the doctor with a headache. Both led to severe crisis for these families. These families, including myself, eventually turned to Facebook begging for help. This is not a way to spend the last year and days of your loved one's life. I think as a state, we can do better. The most important thing in long-term care providing is that everyone works as a team. We are asking the state legislature to join that team. Help us live up to our responsibilities. Help us to help each other. The caregivers I have known are people of great hope and faith. We are committed to the dignity of life until the last breath. These people that we care for, they're not patients to us. We remember what life was like before sickness. We lean on God, but also know that God expects us to help each other. The first time I testified on this issue was 2015. Since then, all of the loved ones in my stories have passed on. But I am still here today asking for this because I know somebody today in this state is going to get news that's going to change their life forever. And I sincerely thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you very much. Next testifier is Stephanie Menning, followed by Shannon Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Stephanie Menning. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association. The Minnesota Utility Contractors Association, or MUCA, represents over 140 contractors and suppliers engaged in excavation, site work, and construction of underground infrastructure, from water, sewer, stormwater pipes to gas, electric, cable, and other utilities. These are critical services necessary for everyday life that are often taken for granted until Minnesota residents can't flush their toilet, get a clean glass of water to drink, or take a hot shower. I'm here today in the hopes of persuading this body to preserve the rights of private employers. MUCA members and their thousands of employees request that you protect commerce by not enacting a one-size-fits-all benefits package. According to the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Minnesota is at a 2.8% unemployment rate for the fourth month in a row. As I'm sure you know, 3% unemployment is considered full employment. Deed also stated that for the full year, Minnesota added 31,441 jobs, a growth rate of 1.1%. That was below the national rate of 1.8% and ranks us as 27th nationally, 12 spots worse from 2017. In other words, we are already heading in the wrong direction. Workplace mandates will continue to hurt Minnesota's job growth rate and will have a negative effect. The construction industry in particular already suffers from a major lack of available workers, as noted by the several bills this body is proposing to help increase workers to the trades, especially those in underrepresented communities of minority and women workers and business owners. For those that are here testifying today in support of this bill, I implore you, if you are not getting the benefits you believe you deserve, or if you think your current job isn't offering you enough pay, time off, or coverage, the construction industry has jobs. Lots of jobs available. We need a variety of skill sets with excellent pay and benefits already offered, and they will train you. As citizens of the United States and in a free market economy, you have the freedom to change jobs. Great wages and winters off await you. NUCA member companies vary in size. Some have 7 to 10 employees, others have several hundred. All of them want to attract the best workers. The best way they can do this is through the freedom to operate their business, determine their own wage and benefit packages, and distinguish themselves from their competitors. We ask that you do not pass this legislation, as 24 weeks of paid leave is essentially the entirety of the construction season in Minnesota. The construction industry as a whole does not have a full pipeline supply of ready workers, much less anyone waiting on the bench to jump in the ditch. For an industry that is already in dire straits, and when it comes to workforce availability, this bill will do more harm than good, and more importantly, it will hurt those you seek to help. I ask you to consider the undue burden these labor mandates place on business. They will increase costs to both employers and employees and will result in Minnesota's continuing decline in the job growth rate. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. The next testifier is Shannon Burns. Following that, a representative from Doherty and Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association. Thank you. Please state your name and then proceed to your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shannon Burns, and I support House File 5 and appreciate your time today. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee. I am the founder and owner of Dunord Consulting. I'm a small business consultant that helps businesses start and grow. I'm located in Alexandria, Minnesota, but have clients nationally. I am also one of the West Central Minnesota Regional Small Business Development Center consultants, so I am able to help small businesses start and grow their dream. I have one employee currently, and the impacts of paid leave and the passing of this file, House File 5, would be significant on my clients and the small businesses in rural Minnesota. As many of you know, Alexandria is home to one of the most beautiful places in the state. We have over 50 lakes in our county, but we aren't just a tourist destination. We are a vibrant and diverse community of entrepreneurs and small business owners, and it is very hard to recruit long-standing and long-term talent. We are very, very vibrant, as I mentioned, but it is hard to create jobs and retain the talent without the support of bills like this. Impacts on my particular business have been significant. I recently had two very spectacular employees who have a wealth of knowledge in my industry and who have moved into the community for positions such as mine. They are highly qualified, and I recently lost an employee due to this issue. I had vetted her for over a year, recruited her for a significant amount of time while she was pregnant with twins, and waited for her to come on board my organization with the promise that she was very excited and ready to jump into work. I have a very flexible scheduling and management style, and so she and I talked over those many months about what her position would look like and how I would be able to support her as a new mother. However, after 4 months, and only 4 months, she resigned due to the fact that I was not able to provide her paid time off due to caring to her twins. It has made a significant impact on my business because not only did I wait for her to come on board, I now have this hole in my talent, which has made a very significant impact on my other employee and myself. I also have recently been a caregiver to my father, who had a very, very significant cancer surgery. He had a prognosis of 12 weeks of recovery, and so I actually took 2 weeks unpaid off of my own work schedule to be able to care for him after my mother had to go back to work because she had no more PTO available to her, and she was not afforded paid medical leave to care for him. It has made a significant impact on our family because he does have ongoing care requirements, although he is finally back to work. And he thankfully had paid time off and paid medical leave through his employer, but does not have any more medical leave available to him after those 12 weeks to be able to have continuous treatments. So I strongly urge you to vote in favor of House File 5. It has made a significant impact on my family, and this passing will make a significant impact on our small business community for the positive. Thank you again for your time today, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. The next testifier, if there's a representative from Doherty in Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association, the next after that will be Hannah Simmons. Sir, if you could please state your name and then proceed to the testimony.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Revenue. I'm substituting for Tim Doherty. I'm with the law firm of Seton Peters and Revenue, a labor and employment firm. But I'm appearing here on behalf of the Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association, where I serve as a board member. The Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association is the largest staffing association in the state, representing over 983 staffing companies. Our members employ, on average, roughly 62,000 people each day, and we traditionally help many Minnesotans find full-time jobs. Our labor market flexibility is widely recognized by economists as a key factor in innovation, growth of new technologies, and job creation. Staffing firms play a vital role in providing flexibility for workers and a bridge to employment. Minnesota staffing and recruiting companies match thousands of people to thousands of jobs each and every day. We offer a wide variety of job seekers a path to permanent employment as well as job flexibility. Much more than stopgap labor source, the staffing and recruiting industry provides businesses across Minnesota an educated and seasoned pool of talent. While we appreciate the goals of House File 5, as a business owner and a representative of the Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association, we believe that Minnesota employers are in the best position to design benefit packages that serve the distinct needs of each of our businesses and our employees. Beyond that, the bill creates several unique challenges for the staffing industry that I wanted to bring to the committee's attention. First, many of the individuals we work with may be employees of our agencies on some assignments, and they may be employees of an entity that they are placed with in other instances. And so as a result, this bill certainly will create challenges for these employees in determining the responsible entities. Secondly, the legislation requires that a job be protected and that an employee be reinstated after leave. While this is a challenging goal for all employers, especially small businesses, it fails to recognize the unique employment setting in the staffing industry. Under the bill, an individual could be placed in a temporary job, take leave before placement is complete, and then return and expect to be placed in the job which was temporary and may no longer exist. Under the current language in the bill, our membership could face fines, penalties, and legal action due to no fault of their own. It would be impossible to guarantee a position with an entity which we have no control over. The last points I want to bring to your attention is the bill requires business to cover independent contractors who may have multiple jobs and are entities businesses have no control over. Lastly, if an employer were to implement a private plan which meets the requirements of this legislation, they would be required to pay additional fees to the state in order to make the state benefit pool sustainable. Instead of penalizing employers for offering benefits, the state would be better served offering assistance to employers who work with their employees to design benefit packages and meet their employees' needs. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee.
Thank you. The next testifier is Hannah Simmons. Following that will be Tom Taylor. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Hannah Simmons. I'm a constituent from Farmington, Minnesota. I work in public health here in St. Paul, and my husband works out of Vermilion. I really appreciate your time today to allow me to share my story. My life irrevocably changed in April of 2017. I lost my job as a manager of program development at Allina Health unexpectedly. I was the primary earner and policy insurance holder for my family. I was also 33 weeks pregnant with our second child. We didn't know if we were having a boy or a girl, but we found out 6 weeks later when our son Grayson was born on May 20th. But our joy quickly dissipated when he started struggling to breathe just minutes after birth. We had no idea why I had had a healthy pregnancy. I was terrified. I didn't know if my baby was going to live or die. Just 6 hours after delivering my son, my husband and I were driving ourselves to Children's Hospital, where we learned that our new baby had been born with an undiagnosed critical congenital heart defect, and he would need open heart surgery the next day to live. Everything happened so quickly, I was having a hard time holding myself together. I was trying to stay strong for my family, trying to be there for my new baby. I had a 2-year-old son at home. I was worried about how we would pay the medical expenses now in addition to our normal household bills. I was worried about finding a new job. I was worried about if I would have time to be home and take care of my son, worried about keeping track of his appointments and medications, and worried about how this would impact his future and our lives forever. My husband was worried too. He worked for a small implement with no paid family leave and very little sick or vacation time. He's an agriculture mechanic, and our baby was born during a very busy season. He was under a lot of pressure to return. The savings that we had worked so hard to build had vanished very quickly. Our son was in the hospital for almost 2 weeks, and my husband did stay home another two when we brought him home, all unpaid, before he was forced to return to work in order to keep our family afloat. As my baby got better, I got worse. I was diagnosed with postpartum depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. But the hardest thing was seeing my husband trying to keep it all together for our whole family. He was doing everything he could to support us financially, emotionally, and you could just see the weight of the world on his shoulders every day. We have no close family in Minnesota. We had to continue paying daycare for our toddler just to hold his spot, and we struggled to make ends meet. I took my baby to his medical appointments and brought him to my own counseling sessions. It took me 5 months to find a new job, and we all continued to heal. But yet, 2 years later, we still have not fully recovered emotionally or financially. Paid family leave would have made a tremendous difference during this traumatic time in our lives. It would have helped us sleep at night and helped us get through the day. It would have given us some much-needed security in a time of extreme uncertainty, and it would have enabled us to be present and care for each other fully during the most difficult time of our lives. Life can change in the blink of an eye for any Minnesota family like mine. We are forced to make decisions in this current climate based on fear instead of what's best for our families. Our babies could have a better start. Our families could have more stability. Our state would be stronger, and our legislature would be leaders if we had a comprehensive paid family leave policy in Minnesota that supported us when we needed it most. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that story and for testifying today. Next will be Tom Taylor, followed by Dr. Hannah Lixon. If could state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Taylor. I own a company called the Shippers Resource Center, Incorporated in Burnsville. We have 12 employees and provide shipping software and logistics management. I'm here today because I'm concerned about the impact of the proposed legislation you have before you, the effect it would have on my company and my employees. As Representative Halverson indicated early on in her opening statement, said one of the greatest challenges small companies have is attracting and retaining employees. As a small company, I'm often unable, like so many others said, I'm often unable to match the medical benefits programs and other perks that larger companies offer. The one area we have been able to compete in is attracting employees is by providing benefit packages that are flexible to our employees' needs. Benefits packages that aren't your typical cookie-cutter programs that are offered by the larger companies. For example, we have an employee with three special needs kids. It's a disease called Sensenbrenner disease, very debilitating. They need significant care, frequent unscheduled visits to the emergency room. This gentleman, he was looking for a job that allowed him to leave on short notice, work from home, and the ability to take several hours off each week on short notice. Fortunately for him and for us, we've been able to accommodate him and attract him away from a company four times our size that was unable to do that. We have another employee that is a pastor, who is a wife of a pastor of a local church. In addition to wanting to take time off during Christmas and Easter season, she is often called on to minister those in crisis situations. We've been able to accommodate hers. We had another employee that had cancer, and we put together a back-to-work program that continued his pay while he was recovering for more than 26 weeks. Someone wants to take an afternoon off to attend a son or daughter's concert or needs to take an elderly mother to the doctor once a week, by all means, do it. We don't mind. Don't clock out. Just go. Now, how does this flexibility benefit us? Because part of working for us is that we ask our employees to be flexible with our needs. Let me give an example. We have two people in our company that manage our software product. It is a job that is not just anyone can do. Very technical and requires a deep working knowledge of our software infrastructure. It can take more than a year to learn it. Approximately a year and a half ago, one of the two employees in this department announced some really good news his wife was expecting. While excited, he understood that he made some commitments to clients that, if not fulfilled, would have a big impact on our company, in his livelihood, and the livelihood of the other employees. So working together, we agreed on a schedule that allowed him to take off four full weeks and then 4 weeks of part-time. A great plan, a win-win for everyone. Fast forward 1 month. The other employee in the department, the one with three special needs kids, announces that his wife is now expecting. This, my friends, is something very few managers, if any, would ever have anticipated. But we made it work by negotiating a family leave schedule that worked for everyone. Even if we could afford another employee, and this is a $100,000 a year job, there's no way that person would have been up and trained in time. No way whatsoever. Had we been required to give them both full 12 full weeks of PTO, we would not just have a 0.36% problem, we would have had a survival problem because there would have been no one to keep our servers up and running, no one to address the customer IT issues, and no one to help us keep our contractual obligations that were needed to keep and cover payroll. Members of the committee, I can assure you that my company is not unique. I've spoken with many of my fellow small business owners who have shared similar stories. The bottom line is that without flexibility, small companies would be unable to attract employees, or worse, their companies and their employees would be at risk. I'm asking you that you make certain that the legislation preserves this needed flexibility so companies like mine can survive and employees like my companies can continue to leave the quality of life working for a company like mine can provide. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Dr. Hannah Lixon, followed by Robin Rowan. Thank you. Please state your name for the record, then proceed to your testimony.
Sure. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Hannah Lixon. I am an internist, a pediatrician, a mother, a daughter, and a lifelong Minnesotan. I'm also here today representing Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity, and I'm here to discuss the importance of paid family and medical leave for all Minnesotans. This is a policy that will improve the lives of citizens across the state. In particular, paid leave will help our most marginalized families thrive under challenging circumstances. Currently, most low-wage earners do not have access to paid leave. This amplifies both health and economic disparities in Minnesota because our community members who experience poverty and discrimination are both more likely to lack access to paid leave and would also benefit from it the most. As a physician in our state, I'm able to speak about the challenges our neighbors encounter when facing illness. They need to put food on the table and pay the rent, but this sadly leads Minnesotans to sacrifice their health in dangerous ways. For example, I take care of a young man with a genetic illness called sickle cell anemia. It leads to frequent life-threatening infections and episodes of severe pain requiring prolonged hospitalizations and recovery time. He has lived with this illness his whole life and was successful in finishing college despite multiple health setbacks. He pushed through to get a bachelor's degree and a job in IT. Not long after starting his first job, he was hospitalized for a bone infection. He was told by his doctors to rest for 2 weeks at home while taking antibiotics. But without the income from his job, his home would disappear, so he went back to work immediately. Unfortunately, this led to a worsening infection, 1 more week in the hospital, and 2 additional surgeries, only compounding both his health and financial difficulties. He sacrificed his health in order to get back to work, and in the end had to give up his apartment anyway. This could all have been prevented if he had access to paid family and medical leave. Like this young man, paid family and medical leave would be truly life-changing and potentially life-saving to thousands of Minnesotans. Generosity is no substitute for justice, and the Paid Family Medical Leave Act is one step toward a more equitable and just Minnesota. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Next is Robin Rowan, followed by Jill Larson. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI members promote the financial security of Minnesotans by providing life, disability, and long-term care insurance, as well as annuities and other retirement plans. We support over 50,000 jobs in Minnesota, and our agents, financial advisors, and investment advisors are located in every corner of the state. MFSI members are also employers, and in such, we share some of the concerns about House File 5 that were expressed by other business groups, but I'm going to focus my testimony on the areas where it uniquely impacts the insurance industry, and one of those areas is the independent contractor area, and Chair Halverson and I have talked about it, and we'll continue to talk about it, and I thank her for her time, but all of our agents, investment advisors, brokers are also small business owners. And the way the bill is currently written, they actually get taxed twice, once as employees of the insurance company as 1099s, and then once as employers for the small business folks. And I know that's not the intent of the bill, and we're going to figure that out. We also found another wrinkle in that on the property and casualty side, if a policyholder has his home repaired or his car repaired by an independent contractor, that's also another 1099 employee, and I'm pretty sure they don't want to be an employee of the insurance company. But secondly, and perhaps and more importantly, while the opt-out or private plan substitution provisions in the bill are improved, we still are concerned about the impact on the bill and what is a very robust and competitive short-term disability market and the emerging fully insured family leave market. The bill still penalizes employers for offering a private market plan by imposing an annual fee, which is 5% of what they would have been paid for the state-run plan. We used there are no premium amounts in the bill currently, but we used numbers from Washington State, and it still would be tens of thousands of dollars annually to have your own private plan. The short-term disability is widely available and affordable right now for employers of all sizes. And fully insured family plans are growing. Small businesses with as few as 2 employees are eligible to receive short-term disability. A 20-person firm, construction firm, can have a 12-week policy for as little as $400 a month with no employee contribution. Insurance companies can also offer benefits that the state won't be able to, such as increased benefits for employees who are able to return to work early. They also reimburse employers for modifying the workplace to help a disabled employee return early. So again, with no premium amounts in the bill, it's impossible for us to compare what the private market premiums would be to those in the bill. But insurers already have the experience, the infrastructure, the staff, the reserves, the solvency protection, the safety net if something goes wrong. So we would respectfully ask the chair, Chair Halverson, and the committee to look for ways to encourage employers to take advantage of the existing market for the benefit of employees, employers, and taxpayers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next is Jill Larson, and following that will be Sarah Riveros.
On the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. For those of you that aren't familiar with our group, our members are mainly large employers headquartered in Minnesota. So we're the employers that you've been talking about today that already do provide pretty generous benefits, including various types of paid leave. I'll try not to repeat what others have said, but I want to say that we, like others, really appreciate the goal of this proposal and support it. We understand the reasons for it. We do have some concerns about the scope of the bill, the funding mechanism, and a lot of details that are in the bill that I'm not going to have time to go into today, but we'll follow up with Chair Halverson with. I think it's been mentioned only a handful of states currently have something like this in place right now, and of those, four of those states have an existing temporary disability insurance plan in place that they built upon. Minnesota doesn't have that. So we do have some concerns about both the startup costs and the long-term ongoing costs of an approach like this. And as Ms. Rowan said, we'd like to have the legislature look at possibly other voluntary or less expansive, you know, bureaucratic ways of filling the need for the folks that don't have the leave now. Specifically regarding the benefits, as was mentioned, this is a new mandate on every employer in the state, both public and private, to provide 24 weeks of paid leave, which is fairly expansive and is quite a bit more than what's been called for in the other states that have a program like this. The amendment did deal with one of our concerns regarding running concurrently with the federal Family Medical Leave Act. But there are still great differences between the FMLA and the provisions in this bill that will cause some pretty substantial administrative burdens and costs. There's provisions in the bill technically to allow an employer that provides a paid leave plan to opt out, but the way that it's worded, few employers will actually qualify for the exclusion because even if they offer generous benefits, most of them aren't going to provide 24 weeks exactly as prescribed in this legislation. For example, an employer might provide 10 weeks of paid leave at 100% wage replacement, but it doesn't meet the requirements. And the bill doesn't allow for any offsetting of current benefits. And so it really does create a disincentive for an employer to provide a private plan, which I don't think is the goal. Finally, the tax is a concern to us. Employers are essentially going to be asked to pay twice, paying once for the benefit they're already providing and paying into a new payroll tax, which doesn't really create an incentive to add employees if you're going to be taxed on them. So as we move forward, we ask that the legislature look at ways to address this problem without disrupting what's working right now for employers and employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Sarah Riveros, we followed by Laura Kushner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and then proceed to to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Degner-Riveros, and I live in St. Paul and am a college professor. I teach Spanish full-time at a private four-year university here in the Twin Cities. My first calling is as a mom, and I'm a single mother of five children. My work provides for the needs of my children, and I'm fully dependent on my income from teaching to provide for my family. As a single parent in academia, I do not miss work. I cannot afford the risk of being considered an unreliable employee. There are no subs for college classes, and planning for an absence means that I have to hire someone myself and pay out of pocket for that person to teach a class for me. I do not feel safe asking for time off to care for my kids, since I am like more than 70% of university faculty who are either pre-tenure or in contingent positions, and our contracts feel very vulnerable. I cannot afford for my children to be seen as a liability, so missing work is not an option. Leave for recovering from childbirth and establishing breastfeeding is an essential human right for the mother-baby dyad. Three of my children were born during graduate school. With my fourth child, I returned to teaching and working on my feet in the classroom full-time exactly 2 weeks to the day postpartum. I breastfed my son during 10-minute breaks between classes and during office hours, and I went home every day to grade papers in bed. I lost a lot of weight and sleep. My health and my marriage suffered tremendously because of the stress of being caregiver and food source for my baby. God is good, and women are strong, and because I had done this with my three older children, I knew how to advocate for my son's needs and my own. So I managed to teach well, to keep my job, and to keep my children healthy, and to nurse my son for over 3 years, like my other children. But the stress and strain of the tensions contributed to the breakdown of the marriage, and eventually I left home with a protective order and some terrible traumatic memories for which I continue to seek therapy. As a survivor of domestic violence, I'm so glad to see that this bill provides leave for people who are experiencing domestic violence. Safety planning, court hearings, and recovering a safe home take time and energy. Moving and creating safety for my children in 2015 cost me one-fourth of a year's salary that year, and by not missing a day of work, I stayed employed. But I was broke, broken, and exhausted. Being a woman and a mother in a society that does not recognize our labor is a difficult role. I have always given my children what they needed, even when the stakes were high and the cost was personal. I was the mom bringing a newborn in a sling to faculty and department meetings, traveling to conferences with my children, my mom, and my sister, sitting in the back of the room to nurse a baby and carve out a scholarly presence, and working to keep my job while risking my health to do so. We can do better. We owe parents and children the security of having access to income as well as time to caregive, to rest, and to have a safe home. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Laura Kushner, followed by Keith Carlson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Laura Kushner. I work for the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm the HR director there. First, I want to say we have met with proponents of the bill and brought in a number of our HR and finance staff from cities to ask questions about implementation and provide feedback, and we really appreciate that. Thank you. We've also testified on this bill at an earlier hearing with some concerns, and we really appreciate that this amendment has addressed a couple of our bigger concerns, so thank you for that as well. However, we do have some remaining concerns as city employers. For example, job protections for probationary and seasonal employees. So, for example, if a seasonal worker at a city, which cities hire a lot of seasonal workers, is hired at the beginning of June and takes 12 weeks of leave at the beginning of June and then is returns in September, but the job is already done, that's not going to work very well for us. Also, the total of 24 weeks of paid leave, our cities are concerned about that amount of leave. It is almost half of the year, and it could be particularly hard for some of our smaller cities with only a few employees. And of course, we also have to provide 24/7, 365 public safety, police and fire. In addition to addressing these concerns, we'd like to suggest a couple of other changes. We would like the ability to exclude, not by an entire employer, but by job class or bargaining unit, so that if we are providing substantial benefits to those groups, we could get those excluded without having to exclude the entire employer. And then we would also like our cities would like the requirement to, like to be able to require employees to use paid leave first. We are cities are very generous in general with regard to paid leave. and it makes almost every other leave law out there allows you to require that employees use paid leave first, and we think that would be a good change to this law as well. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next is Keith Carlson, to be followed by Tanya Holt. Mr. Carlson, while you're getting set up, I do understand that you have a PowerPoint, and that's what we're waiting for right now. And I just ask that you try and keep it to 3 minutes when you testify, just like the other testifiers have generally done.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I appreciate the staff accommodating my request. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And I also want to thank Representative Halverson for meeting with me and other county representatives and having responded to some of our concerns with regards to coordination with FMLA. But like the others, we still have additional concerns. The first of those is that, has already been indicated, we are paying twice. We appreciate the need to provide these leaves for employees and already provide generous leaves for employees for almost all the circumstances identified under this bill. Three counties currently are providing paid paternity leave for 3 weeks for their employees right now. The issue with regard to the leave and our paid leave is always more generous because we provide 100% coverage, not from 90% to 60%, depending on the, but that does create issues that I'll just touch on later. At the 0.31%, local government's costs will incur at least $34 million of cost under this bill. And our employees will incur the same. They will likely try and recoup that at the bargaining table to the extent they are union represented. So our costs kind of double up. As I indicated, we already provide most of the leaves contemplated. We provide 12 weeks of pregnancy and parenting leave under the state law as well as the FMLA. We provide leave for care of ill and injured employees because we already provide paid sick leave or paid time off. And we provide up to 4 weeks of safety leave for victims of sexual assault, domestic abuse, and stalking. We are concerned with the stacking that has already been identified between the medical and family benefits up to 24 weeks of leave. Approximately half a year would have to be covered by us by both hiring replacement to do the work that's not done by the employee who's on leave, and also we will continue to pay benefits to that employee based on the current employer's share. As again has been indicated by others, we'd like to have paid leave be required to be taken first, because if the employee does not do that, that will penalize us by going towards an adverse experience rating and raising the tax that we should pay. Since we've already paid for that leave, we believe it should be utilized first with some de minimis, say 1 week, having to be retained. Finally, we have issues with regards to how this coordinates with workers' comp and disability insurance. We don't believe employees should get twice, be able to double dip. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We're going to proceed to the rest of the testifiers, but if you would stick around in case there are questions at the end. Thank you. Tanya Holt is next, and followed by Jessica Peterson-White. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Of course. My name is Tanya Holtz. I am the owner of a child care center in Woodbury, Minnesota, and thank you for your time. I just want to start out by saying this is frankly incredibly hard for me. I support paid family leave. Let me start out by saying that. I employ 35 teachers and child care providers, early education experts, majority of them women. I support my team. However, I'm concerned about the unintended consequences of this bill, and I just urge you in your conversations to take into account some of the things that may happen, I guess, in my school. We are regulated. I have a whole speech prepared, and so make it last. Just bear with me. We are regulated by Minnesota DHS. We are a licensed child care facility. We are also an accredited private school and early education center. Therefore, as a licensed facility, we must meet specific ratios every day to legally open our doors and care for the children. We care for 200 children every week, and we serve over 145 families in our area. As opposed to many other businesses where being short-staffed might lead to longer lines or a decrease in customer service, we legally cannot open our classrooms and serve the working families that we already do. As I said, on the one hand, I support my team. I wish that every staff person in my building would have paid time off. I wish they or paid family leave. I'm sorry. They already get paid time off for me. Since September, we had 10% of my entire staff was out on maternity leave, and that's great for brand new babies. It was wonderful. We were able to make it work by having the team rally around one another and take overtime shifts to care for the children. When I take a look at the unintended consequences of 24 weeks being taken by individuals in my on my staff, if they need it, I totally understand. However, I have to look at the children entrusted to my care, those being the children of the 145 families. Early education experts will all tell you that consistency in care is king. That's what leads to high quality. That's what leads to thriving children. And so when working moms and dads bring their children to my school, when we have a revolving door on a classroom for one intention or one reason or another, who suffers is the children in the classroom, frankly. And that's something that all of us as early education providers struggle with. A staff person out on a 12-week paid leave whom could receive theoretically up to 90% of their paid salary is or 24 weeks, excuse me, of 90% of their paid salary is theoretically incented to stay out for that long, and I have to replace that person with another licensed, qualified caregiver. I don't mind that. If you can find them for me, I would take them. We are experiencing a hiring shortage unlike anything I have ever seen in our 11-year history. I have candidates who come and they say, oh, well, I will absolutely work for you. They're not qualified. They are oftentimes not competent. And the empathy doesn't exist. On the other hand, those folks who the empathy exists, the competency is there, they might not have the college credit hours or the continuing education units demanded or required by DHS. And there's no shortcut to get that. And so that's the concern that we have. We have less turnover than any other school in our area, but yet I spend, I'm embarrassed, an entire teacher's salary every year just recruiting to find teachers. It's really hard, and I'm sure you all are aware that there is a child care shortage in the state of Minnesota, and centers like mine are in jeopardy of closing all the time. I challenge the committee to consider other options. I would love to go back and tell my staff, you guys all can have 24 weeks of paid time off, but then I need a whole other staff waiting in the wings to fill that in. Do you know what I'm saying? And the other part of that is if I have to go find 5, 6, 7, 10 employees to pay full time to wait in the wings, we'll figure it out. Rates will go up, something will give, whatever, right? But you don't understand an early education provider. You don't go and find a preschool teacher and tell them that they're in the bullpen until something happens. They want their own classrooms. They want their own kids. They want to be in the mix of everything. And so, therefore, you can't be in school on Monday and just wait for your shot. And it's a six-week turnaround. I heard the gentleman say, ramping someone up. It's a six-week ramp-up process to get teachers prepared to go into the classroom to care for your children. And that's what we're talking about here, is the care for your children. Everyone has a story, and I totally understand that. I have my own children, but I have to consider the 200 children that have been entrusted to my care every single week and the staff people that I employ. I believe in taking care of my employees. I want to say that loud and clear to everyone in this room and everyone beyond. I do not want this to be misinterpreted. We offer paid time off for all our full-time employees. We offer paid training, meals, uniform allowance, 401k, paid health care, regular wage reviews, and performance raises. We know the value of providing a solid employees benefits package. Frankly, it's how we compete. It's how we set ourselves apart from the other child care providers and employers in our area. I believe in providing a safe environment, a competitive wage, and a benefits package for my entrusted employees. I look out for my teachers and my kids. I don't, however, believe that the details have been considered and the unintended consequences to my kiddos has been taken into account, and I just request that you would all do so. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Next is Jessica Peterson-White, and then our last testifier is Sarah Pippenberg. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Sure. I'm Jessica Peterson-White. I own Content, a thriving independent bookstore in downtown Northfield, and I also serve on the Northfield City Council. Last year, the Northfield Council passed a six-week paid family leave policy, and in considering it, we heard stories. City employees who planned to change jobs to move out of the public sector before having kids because they couldn't afford an unpaid leave, using up vacation time to be home with a baby, and then facing a choice between quitting or going back to work with a one-month-old infant at home. These stories represent costs in replacing staff, but also in morale, because people are being forced to choose between what's best for their families and their jobs. We're really proud of our policy, and it's a good start, but the unpredictable budget for it for the city of Northfield has been the really big challenge. It's hard to guess what the costs are going to be in a year, and that's an especially big challenge for small and medium-sized employers. What would help us and our taxpayers and our employers most would be to share the risk through a program like the one that's proposed here. It makes sense to ask employers and employees to contribute to a statewide fund, which would benefit everyone when they need it and protect us all from variations in costs. I have two kids of my own, and the second was born after I opened the bookstore. I budgeted to have about a month home with the baby full-time, and then I kind of eased back into work. It was too expensive to cover all of my hours, so I spent a lot of days and nights with a baby and a laptop in my arms or with the baby napping behind the counter. Self-employment gave me flexibility, but it also meant I had to make painful trade-offs between investing in my business and caring for my son. Statewide paid leave would have made it possible for me to take time off without sacrificing resources I could otherwise have devoted to growing my business. And it would ensure that when one of my five employees has a new child or an unexpected illness or family member to care for, they could care for their families and return when they're ready to work, while my business would have the resources to cover their responsibilities. I don't think anyone in this room believes that babies should go to daycare 2 weeks or 6 weeks after birth, or that it's humane to force a new mom back to work at that point either. But if we're not providing a system that keeps family income steady during those precious early months, we're pretending that that is realistic. Or we're pretending that working parents can afford to skip a few paychecks. Every city employee, every Content bookstore employee has a family counting on them to be both caregivers and breadwinners. Nobody should have to choose between the well-being of their child and their job. Please support a paid family leave system to ensure that all families get a healthy and secure start. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Sarah Pippenberg.
If you'll note, I wasn't initially on the list, so I thank you so much for including me today. This is a little difficult for me. First of all, my name is Sarah Pippenberg, and I own Vinaigrette. It's a retail vinegar store in Minneapolis, Excelsior, and Navarre. I started out with my story, which is I have an employee, Linda, who actually worked for 27 years for the phone company. and approaching her retirement, realized she didn't have enough money in retirement, so she got a job at my retail store. 2 years ago, she fell, and she broke both of her arms, which was devastating. And while we told her to take time to heal, payroll came around, and I went to her apartment with her paycheck. And she was sitting with a TV tray in front of her. She was deciding about if she was going to make rent or how she could figure that out with her leasing agent. She was also deciding what she could cut as far as her food was concerned, or whether or not she was going to sell her car. I came with her full check. She was more than grateful, and we were honored to be able to do that for her. But in her 6-week time out, not only did I have to find somebody to cover her shifts, I was also paying for her. I have 3 children, so if I was covering her shifts, we're trying to figure out daycare. So what ultimately happened is I didn't pay my mortgage. I was late on my commercial rent payment. And the reason why this is so emotional to me right now is today at 2:45, Linda texted me to say, I'm going in. She's having hip replacement. She's going to be out for 10 weeks. I don't know how to tell her that I can't afford to pay her. With this plan, I could afford to pay her. This would give me the opportunity to do right by my employee. Now, whether or not this is available, I'm still going to make the right decision. I'm still going to pay Linda, but my family will in turn suffer. I've heard the chamber speak. I was a member of the Edina Chamber. I'm a member of the Excelsior Chamber. The conversation is absolutely untrue. Talk to the small Main Street chambers. This is important to us, extremely important to us. I've heard insurance say, we offer these private suites. If you don't think after 10 years I haven't done my due diligence, I'm desperate to provide health care for my employees, a 401k, and insurance, but I will tell you, it is absolutely not affordable. She was quoted a $400 a month payment. That is unaffordable. But this I can plan for. This I can afford. Not to mention, as a business owner, I'm excited about the opportunity to pay in on my own behalf so that I have the opportunity to take care of either my loved ones or, God forbid, something happened to me or my husband. I wasn't really prepared for this. If this doesn't kind of go through, like I said, Linda's out for 10 weeks now, somebody needs to give me the wording, and whether it be somebody that's against this, tell me how I tell Linda no. Tell me how I say to Linda, you're not worthy. And when I see these people saying, well, it's going to cost us, in 12 weeks, these kinds of things, 24 weeks, why are we vilifying our employees? I've had an unlimited sick time since the history of my business. Not one of my employees has ever taken advantage of that. And I'm not saying extenuating circumstances don't happen, but if someone needed 24 weeks because they have a family member that's sick or themselves that is sick, I wholeheartedly want to support them, because the other piece, if I got rid of Linda, so I guess that's what people are saying, she's out for 10 weeks, I can't afford to pay her, so her time is done at Vinaigrette, or I just don't pay her and hope that she comes back. The thing about it is that would cost me over $3,000 to retrain a new employee, and I just have a little retail job. I can't imagine what some of these other business owners have as far as their, employee costs to train and rehire new people. So if I could just say, please, 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 please consider that there are a number of small business owners that are 100% in support of this, and give us the opportunity to do right by our employees. Many of us are still going to do that, but there's a lot of people that would have the opportunity to really do right by their employees. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the end of the list of people who had signed up to testify. Is there anyone else in the room who didn't sign up or wishes to testify? Seeing no one, I think now would be a good time, perhaps for questions for the author. Are there members of the committee with questions? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions for Representative Halverson. First of all, since we already are over our time, are you planning on coming back this evening? Because I can imagine that with a couple of dozen testifiers that members probably do have questions and they just don't know the path as to what we're planning to do tonight. Again, very, very important piece of information, and I don't think that we want to make a decision in just a couple of minutes. Can you help us to determine what the plan of action is going to be, or Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I think the intention at this point is to continue going. So if there are questions, we have the room for the evening. So now is the time for members to articulate their questions, and we'll just continue going as long as need be. Chair Halverson.
And Mr. Chair, I believe that we did alert folks that this was a hearing that could go over. An email should have come to you from our committee administrator to let you know that this would be one of those days that committee would go late. So we can certainly begin discussion at this time unless people feel like they would like a break.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, I guess I have a couple of questions for you. I've heard people are and very compelling testimony today regarding the plan and that they hope that the plan works. Have we had any opportunity to look at from an actuarial standpoint to see if how this would work? What happens if we don't hit the right mark on this? Will folks be back depending on this or counting on this program only to find out that the system wasn't solvent and didn't have enough money to pay benefits?
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. We have had intensive study that has been done by the University of Minnesota. I have asked Ms. Fitzgerald to be here as well to answer some technical questions. So we start from there. We also have the experience of other states. No paid family medical leave program in any other state has gone insolvent. These have been self-sustaining, and some have been in place for long-term. In addition, we're working very closely with the administration, both at the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Department of Labor and Industry, to work out the math on this. I appreciate your shout-out to the actuaries. They're some of my favorite people as well. And I think that you hit on a really important point, and that is the predictability. We know that the issues that we are talking about are not something planned. We plan time to take a cruise to the Bahamas. We do not plan time to have a high-risk pregnancy. We do not plan time to have a sick family member, and this is about providing the assurance that the time is available and that people can get partial wage replacement and that it will be there for them. So your point is well taken.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, in the state of Minnesota, when insurance companies, whether they be life insurance or health insurance, which is extremely important to individuals as well, admitted carriers are required to go through the actuarial review and then also be granted a license to sell in the state of Minnesota. They are also to be participants in the Guarantee Association. I respect the fact that you want the program to be solvent, but what happens if it doesn't? Where does the funds come from if Minnesota happens to be the outlier because of the benefit set that's being offered on this compared to other states or health demographics that an actuarial study would actually reveal?
Chair Halverson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I co-direct the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota, and I was the research lead. A national team of experts worked on the design and implementation study for this legislation in 2016. Since that time, even more work has been done with the U.S. Department of Labor, with the American Enterprise Institute, with the Brookings Institute, with a variety of national experts to help even more improve since 2016 the cost modeling software and efforts to understand the costs of these types of programs. That those programs are based on our best available information about leave-taking behavior and mapped on to Minnesota's population. So Representative O'Driscoll, you know, again, taking into account Minnesota's, any uniqueness about Minnesota, those softwares can take that into account and do. So I think Minnesota's in good shape here in terms of being able to rely on the experiences of these six other states, as well as a growing group of national experts who have done very important work to help think about how we cost model these types of programs.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that we hope that we've got this and that we think we've got this. But I heard some pretty compelling testimony today from people who are counting on this program to be the thing that's going to be able to help them. And all I'm looking for is some assurance that we have hit the mark, that we've got this. You said you've collected information. I didn't hear anything that there was an actuarial evaluation, which would require every other carrier in the state of Minnesota, where many of the things that people were talking about today were adjuncts to health-related things and health care and health tragedies. I don't see that we have a safety net in place to be able to protect these individuals. That concerns me greatly that we would go out there with a program, if I could use the term, on a hope and a prayer, without actually having an actual review on this and putting Minnesotans in a position where we tell them the benefits that's going to be there, but we don't know for sure because we haven't tested it or even done any modeling on this at the state level, or we require every other provider of benefits to do that.
Chair Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the work with the departments is ongoing. We actually put the dates in place for the effective date to start the program in place specifically, so there was time to vigorously analyze and test the program, so that when it goes live in 2022, that seems so long, it will be ready, tested, and able to go live. And I've had numerous conversations with the departments and will continue to as department actuaries are part of our analysis.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Listening to this testimony, thanks to everybody that came to testify. It was really helpful to me. Folks that have concerns of the unknown, I think it's legitimate to, you know, have questions and concerns about the unknown. And this has already been alluded to, but we do have some pretty good examples of other states that have embarked on this for a long period of time. Just in a little bit of my own research and looking into this, to California, it appears that concerns about job losses have not materialized. Fears that it would impact small businesses more than large businesses did not materialize. And so I guess question to Representative Halverson or to Ms. Fitzpatrick, is there data or things about the other six states that have implemented this that inform some of the questions or concerns that we heard today from businesses?
Chair Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howard, that is an excellent question, and we're very lucky that we have other states that have undertaken this. More importantly, I've gotten to talk to Minnesota employers that operate in those states. And so there are numerous Minnesota employers who operate statewide who actually are providing paid family leave in states like California and New York, and they are complying successfully with those benefits and able to serve their employees in that way. So that has been some really good feedback. In fact, I talked to an employer today who said, yeah, we actually operate in X state, and it works out fine. We don't have a lot of concerns. That was really reassuring to me. For the data, I will phone a friend and ask Ms. Fitzpatrick to provide the academic analysis.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, we do have really good data out of three states that have had these programs in place for a significant length of time that look at, you know, things like the impact on businesses, different kinds of businesses like manufacturing and retail, for example, that are you know, have to have a worker there and have had to deal with that, some of those issues that were raised today. And again, that research shows that the business experience has been either positive or neutral. And so I think we are able also to build on the experience of those states in the cost modeling work to really look at what happens when different types of people get different types of leave benefits and to be able to bring the best of that information into our into the cost modeling software that we're using to help us understand what might happen in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. And just one final comment. Thank you. This issue, you know, as we've heard, everyone's got their own story. You know, my story, I actually, ironically, had the opportunity to have paid parental leave as an employee of these Minnesota House representatives. And I cannot tell you how grateful I was as a parent to have that opportunity. And I didn't even realize how much I was going to be grateful for it until the opportunity to bond and become a more confident parent through a whole lot of trial and error. But I believe that there was virtue in the Minnesota House representatives offering something like that to our employees here because of the importance of having a productive workforce, retaining our workforce, job satisfaction, the important health outcomes, and we really ought to make sure that all Minnesotans have that ability. And just the last thing, again, there's been a lot of talk about uncertainty. And for me, the uncertainty that struck the biggest chord for me was from Ms. Simmons, who said that paid family leave could provide much-needed security in a moment of extreme uncertainty. And those Minnesotans are the folks that we should be listening to and making sure that they have an ability in those times to be with their loved ones. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not an actuary, but I'm married to one. And so I guess I would be curious if there is just data out in the ether about the small, I would venture to guess, the small possibility of people needing to use all 24 weeks of this leave in 1 year.
I'm guessing this is a question for Ms. Fitzpatrick, but Chair Helmerson?
Well, I'll kick it off, if I may, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think that we heard a lot of concern that there was going to be a huge uptake of 24 weeks of leave. So let's be very clear. The benefit runs concurrent with the federal paid family leave. So you couldn't take unpaid leave and then paid leave sequentially. It would run concurrent. In order to take, in Minnesota, the plan that we're putting together, 24 weeks of leave, you would need to have an incredibly high risk and complicated pregnancy that may necessitate bed rest, that may necessitate hospitalization, in addition to having a sick baby or being sick yourself to recover. Those circumstances, you know, may they be rare. And I think that most of our experiences finds that those are rare, particularly if you can take care of yourself during your pregnancy. If your pregnancy is high risk, then your birth outcomes tend to be better. Your own health outcomes tend to be better. And so I think that it's very important to state. The other thing that I would like to state, just in terms of the notion of being gone for 24 weeks, if somebody would need that, it would be a need. Anybody who has had a baby or welcomed a new baby into their family knows that it's not vacation. There are tears and loss of sleep and fear and intense caregiving. And those are in the best of circumstances. And so I think that that's really important that we really are talking about need. And the 24 weeks that are laid out in the bill, if somebody took that, would have to be applied for and approved based on specific circumstances and in communication with your health professional. So that is specific to the bill. The metadata would come from Professor.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The data from the existing state programs backs up what Representative Halverson is saying. Very, very few people, except for birth parents who have a complicated birth, use both types of leave in any given year. California, to the point that was made earlier about, you know, what people do in the face of very generous benefits, California actually has up to 52 weeks of medical leave, and very, very few people use that. You know, even those particular cases, very few again, where somebody's using both types of leave, you know, the average is more like 14 weeks or 16 weeks, even in the case of a birth parent who's using both types of leave. So again, the experience of the other states, and I think the experience of employers with very generous PTO programs, bears out that people use what they, you know, have to, and don't tend to take advantage of the state programs, at least that are in existence now.
Representative Katiza Batun.
Thank you for painting a much clearer picture of that.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Halverson. I absolutely know where you're going. I appreciate the heavy lift you're trying to do and the compassion behind this. As a small business owner myself, one has worked with others, just make sure you get this right. It is very important, and we can sit around and give lots of accolades and hear the stories of success and the support. But it's important as well to hear the contrarian views, because that will make the policy better. And to that point, just two quick questions. Number one, I noticed the amendment, we're taking a minute out. And so what is the plan for a technological solution and a platform? And how do you avoid the debacles of MNLARS and everything else? Because if you're going to do this, you know, we can't have a rollout like MNsure. So that's what I have.
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cresha. I think you raise a really important point. The amendment does not take minute out specifically, but it gives the department flexibility to choose how they want to approach the technology. I think that we all acknowledge the challenges that the state has faced with some of its technological setups. I have talked specifically with the governor's office and about that concern, and said, what is this going to look like if we're going to set up a big technology program for the state of Minnesota? And they have committed very loudly and forcefully that and maybe mention the governor's military background, that precision and testing are going to be a big part of this program. Again, that's one of the reasons why we looked at the date that we looked at in terms of the rollout. And do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just add that some of the other changes to the in the author's amendment are designed to help allow the Department of Employment and Economic Development to clone the revenue collection system that they have for the UI. So again, we're taking advantage of an existing infrastructure that's already functioning well to the extent that we can, and we're working closely with DEED to, again, to not have to recreate the wheel, to use existing IT infrastructure where it's already working, wherever that can happen. And so that is also some of the changes that were made in the author's amendment were designed to, you know, make that more possible for the department.
Thank you, Professor Patrick. Representative Cresha.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So I have not had a chance to go through, but the governor's budget in detail. It sounds like you've talked to the governor a bit. Did the governor put specifically resources in his budget that could help facilitate this or build something? Because you're building this from scratch, as I understand it. Any other states have done that? Maybe we just want to be like California, so I don't know, maybe we just use their system. But, I mean, those are just things that I'm thinking through in deployments that I've done.
Chair Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kreisha, thank you. Yes, the governor's budget actually has startup costs embedded within it, and so they are looking at making sure that we put the proper resources in place in order to make sure that we build a system that works, and recognizing it takes resources and it takes talent, and making sure that the state can access that talent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just quickly add that Washington State has a lot of very comparable programs to the way that their UI system operates, and their State Department of Employment and Economic Development, and they're a couple years ahead of us on this process, and so we are going to be able to have the opportunity to learn also from their experiences, and those will be, I think, super helpful in having Minnesota you know, again, not recreate the wheel where it's not necessary.
Representative Kreisha. Oh. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kreisha handled a number of my questions, but one additional. Can you...
You could have asked those.
Can you talk about the section where a family member is described and kind of who qualifies to get these benefits?
Mr. Chair... And Representative Haley, that is a great question. And when I said that there's going to continue to be work on this, this is another conversation that I'm continuing to have with stakeholders, with the department and others. One of the things that we are looking for is definitions that respect where people are in their lives and who their caregivers are, and making sure that you can count on the caregiver you want. Some things aren't always linear in life. Also to allow to find definitions that work with what employers are working with now. And so we are doing a fair amount of research, I think, to find that balance. And I think that language is something that I intend to work more on. So if you're wedded to it, don't be. And I think maybe.
Well, I just. Hi. Sorry.
Professor Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just add one of the things that came out of. I just completed a research project looking at how this issue is playing out in rural parts of the state. And this issue of kind of how we think about who does caregiving came up a lot in my conversation with stakeholders in rural parts of the state, and that sometimes it's not a direct family member that's available to take care of someone. And so I think that's part of the balance, trying to figure out how are we, again, saving the state money, helping families all over the state figure out how to get this done, how to support people staying in aging in place, and that issue of particular of how neighbors and friends can step in and do this kind of caregiving when family members are not in proximity did come up. So just wanted to flag that.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. And on a different topic, as I look at this, part of my concern is just the bureaucracy that needs to be created to manage it. Not that the intent isn't appropriate, but a new division indeed, a new claims processing system, new IT department. I mean, have the scope of this is pretty massive. Have you done any estimates on the number of headcount it will require to implement and what the administrative cost is going to look like?
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will say that work is ongoing with the departments. We have initial budget from the governor's office, but the work will continue to be ongoing in terms of that headcount and what the bill ends up looking like. So we're trying to kind of chug through some of these policy issues, because that questions like you asked about family will determine what the ultimate headcount looks like. And so we have one more policy stop before we start finance committees, and so we want to wrap up some of these policy questions so that the analysis that we're doing is the analysis on what we're actually going to be implementing in Minnesota. And we're making a lot of changes at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have to apologize. I had a bill hearing earlier, so if I'm asking a question that's already been answered, I just have a lot of constituents that are asking me. A few weeks ago, when this all first started to come forward, we started talking about this within the legislature. I had a Shakopee Chambers annual luncheon that they have every year, and it was with a bunch of people that I didn't know were sitting at my table, and so I just tossed it out to ask the question as to what does everyone think about this, and it was all our chamber, and the people that I was sitting with are all very small businesses, consulting firms, different things like that, and it was a it was really great to hear back from them to a person. They were all very supportive of a project like this that will help their lives as small business owners. So I just want to toss that out there first, and then on the along those same lines, I've gotten a lot of emails from especially realtors and a couple other folks about being independent business owners and things like that as to if they will be forced to be in this program. I just want to clarify where that's sitting in the bill today and just understand what works for small business owners, especially independent people who are self-employed.
Chair Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tabke, you ask an important question. We did talk about it a little bit, and we did get to hear from the realtors and from the folks representing insure people who work in the insurance industry, so agents. And those are some unique job categories, and we have not, I don't think, gotten to it in the bill where it needs to be at this point. We want to ensure that anybody who works for an employer, whether they're an employee or an independent contractor, but if they get their paycheck from an employer and they get other benefits from the employer and they get their work direction from an employer, you know, that they also can participate in this program, because the point of it is that the benefit follows the employee. And so as people move through their work life, we want to be sure that they can access the benefit, but the benefit follows them. It doesn't stick with their job. And so I think that the point is that we need to do more work with regard to how we're defining those people. Because I agree. I know a lot of realtors. I know a lot of people who sell insurance in my community and, you know, friends, family, whatever. And they are small business owners. So I think that we have to do a little more work in terms of how we define who those folks are. At the same time, there are small business owners who, you know, hang out their own shingle and they're on their own, and you don't get to be sick, or you don't, you know, because you don't get paid. In this particular situation, you could have a baby and not have to come to work in 2 weeks with your you know, your baby strapped to your chest and try to get through your day. You would be able to have partial wage replacement in order to provide you the time and hopefully a healthier return to work.
Thank you.
Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative or Chairman Overson, I totally support this endeavor, and I think that it's like making sausage where, you know, it's going to come out and it's going to be good for all Minnesotans. The one question that I did have, though, League of Minnesota Cities brought it up, and as a former mayor and a counselor, we hire a lot of part-time. And that's where I guess I her question kind of struck me. What does that look like when you hire them part-timers?
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lislegard. First of all, thanks for the sausage comment. I come from a family that owned a meat market, and so did my husband. So we are super supportive of the sausage making, both in my job here and back at our hometown businesses. That said, what are the odds, right? I think that we want to be sure that as many employees as possible can take this. And keep in mind it's partial wage replacement. So if you need to take time off and get chemotherapy, it doesn't discriminate whether or not you know, cancer doesn't discriminate if you work full-time or part-time. Those benefits will be there for you. Again, the benefits follow the employee, and you pay into the system based on how many employees you have and how much you work. So, and perhaps the professor can give a better answer.
Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, I think that one of the things that's important about this kind of statewide approach, right, is that increasingly many people are cobbling together multiple part-time jobs over the course of a year. And the way that this system is designed to work is that all of those wages kind of get, you know, accounted for in the state system through the wage detail. And then when a person needs to take a leave, you know, all that income is kind of coming together. And I think this is where it's important to try to figure out the solution to the contractor situation, right? Because we also see increasingly people cobbling together traditional employment situations and self-employed or contracting situations, and those are also an important part of their earnings over the course of a year. So while it is complicated, I think, you know, figuring out, because those realtors have needs too, right? And the contractors, people who are getting more and more of their income through contracting, also have the same basic needs to be there for their families and to take care of themselves. So we're trying to, you know, get this system set up so, again, the benefits follow the worker in a way, and all of that income that comes from various employers or various sources can come together to reflect kind of what a person earns and what they would need to be able to be solvent during these kind of situations in their life.
Representative Listengard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. That helped clarify that for me.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair, the thought of eating sausage to me is not good. I'm a vegetarian, but hey, in the end, I think this bill will be good. And I just want to make a shout out to Representative Crenshaw saying that we should look at the California model. That sort of surprised me a little bit. Unfortunately, he's not here right now, but I'll be sure to let him know. As I think about this, I mean, I've heard all the testimonies and I've heard the importance of what this would mean to family and family members and maternity, you know, issues for parents who have young children. And have you yet to talk about how this can really have a positive impact on the expenses we pay for social services for those kids who often start in a home where parents are out working two jobs, and so it's a much, much more difficult situation. I mean, many other countries do this just sort of matter-of-factly, and they realize that, you know, we always talk about the most important time for kids are from birth to three, yet we don't do a whole lot to help them, and I think this is a great opportunity to really help those kids and really help those young families. And I haven't heard you talk about it directly. Personally, I think it's probably one of the best parts of this bill, is that we'll begin to have many children all starting out on a good foot and have bright opportunities in their futures moving forward. So maybe more of a comment than a question, but if you want to speak to it, I'd love to hear it.
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. You raise a really important point, and I was smiling when you were describing the importance of the first 3 years. I am a pretty big fan of former Governor Elmer Anderson and Elmer L. used to say, that was C. Elmer Anderson, I'm the Elmer Anderson. So, and in his life, he only served as governor for 2 years in the state of Minnesota, and he went on to head H.B. Fuller. And he thought that birth to three was so incredibly important. He gave employees time off during those first 3 years, dating back to the 70s, before all the science was in and before all the data was in on the importance of that 0 to 3, of prenatal to 3. Now it's so significant and there's so much science behind it, we have a prenatal to 3 committee that's doing this work in the Minnesota House of Representatives. What we see in terms of other countries and other states is that there is an absolute important economic and health benefit that happens in numerous ways, from relieving the caregiving crisis keeping people out of institutionalized care if they have a caregiver at home that can help them through their respite care. Otherwise, they go to a nursing home. And we know that we're facing shortages in access and expense that isn't being covered. We know that if you have paid time off as a new mom, your ability to start and maintain a breastfeeding schedule is much more likely. And we know that breastfeeding is incredibly important for infant health. And so those are just a couple of examples. I could go on and on. But when you look at the resources that we're being asked to spend as a state, the counties are putting out there to try to address caregiving problems, to try to address problems of health in our 0-3 population, this is a piece of that puzzle. For a long time, we have had free, unpaid, unacknowledged caregiving happening in our society. Our world has changed quite a bit. Many more people need to work. We need to have more dual income households. We need to make sure that people just aren't making ends meet. And so this is a piece of that puzzle to get us to a point where the caregiving is done by the people who want to do the caring and who the people who are being cared for want to care for them, right? It's, I want to hold, my family member's hand. I don't want to have to pay somebody to do it if they're sick. So that's a long way of saying you're absolutely right. There's economic benefits. And I think there's probably whole classes and PhD dissertations about it, so I can let the professor comment as well.
Professor Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I could bore you for days, but I won't. I will just say that the research backs up what Representative Halverson is saying. In California, for example, they have shown that it's reduced the need for public assistance, that it has reduced the need to turn to nursing homes or institutional care for older Californians. So definitely, and obviously there's tons of years of experience with this in other countries around the world. So the data definitely, the research definitely backs up what Representative Halverson has depicted.
Representative Dean?
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, just as a scheduling note, it is 4:43 at the moment. We'll continue until 5 p.m. and then, if necessary, take a recess and reconvene at the call of the chair, but no earlier than 6:30 p.m. Members, please watch your emails, and the public can watch the committee webpage to know when we will be reconvening. So we're going to go for another 15 minutes and then take at least an hour and a half recess. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson. I'm sitting here listening to some of your comments and trying to read the language and understand, and I'm just really confused. And it kind of goes back to what Representative Haley was asking about family, because how you define family is how broad this is going to be, how expensive this is going to be, how encompassing this is going to be, how burdensome this will be to a small business, whether it be, a real estate agency, an insurance agency who already came and said that this was pretty much unworkable in their form, the form that they are as a business. So my first question is relating directly to what Representative Haley said when you the definition you have in here right now, which you said don't be married to, about family member is so broad. It says an employee's child, okay, I get that, adult child, spouse, sibling, parent, foster parent, parent-in-law, grandchild, which I appreciate because my grandchild right now is sitting at the hospital for the last 6 weeks. So I appreciate that. Grandparent, domestic partner, step-parent, or any related individual related by blood or affinity with close association. So I don't know what affinity with close association definitely means. With the employee is equivalent of a family relationship. So that is so incredibly broad, that's really could be anybody. So I'm not quite sure how you're going to narrow that. Obviously that needs to have a little bit better definition, but that's not my question. My question is, who is deciding, who is the ultimate decider, who is the person that makes to say who, if they fit this definition or not? Because that is so incredibly broad. I don't know where you're going to go with that or how narrow you're going to be, but who gets to decide? That's my first question. who qualifies as a quote-unquote family member so that they could take time off to do all the things that you were just talking about, which I wish I could go see my grandchild tonight. I just have to say that, because not only do I have this committee, I have another committee that's starting in 15 minutes, yes, with Chair Lush, so I can't go see my grandbaby tonight, even though I really want to. But who decides who is a family member and who gets this benefit?
Chair Oliverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. We, as I said, this is language that we are still trying to work on. And so I'm working to find a more consistent, a definition that's more consistent with the way that employers in Minnesota operate. At the same time, I think it's vitally important that if we are going to take this bold step, we recognize the complexities that go along with caregiving and with family. I think you raise a really good point. I sure know a lot of grandparents who are the primary caregiver for their grandchildren. I know that, you know, in many families, and mine included, you know, we had a great aunt who didn't have any children, and so nieces and nephews were the caregivers for her. And we also have families who may have godparents who are caregivers, we're wrestling with the fact that caregiving doesn't tie up in a really neat bow, and it's not super linear. And so that's why I said this language will likely change for the very reasons that you said. It's we need to be sure that the policy is workable and represents who families are.
Representative O'Neill.
So, Mr. Chair, so I guess, okay, I understand that part, but the part of who's going to decide who qualifies? Is it a state agency? Is it the employer? Is it the Department of Human Rights? I mean, who's going to decide who qualifies and who doesn't? Where's the appeal process? And, you know, structurally, I want to know.
Okay.
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is a clearer question. I'm sorry. I did not answer the question you asked. The agency that decides is DEED. So an employee who wanted the leave would fill out an application that would go to DEED, and they would provide documentation that from healthcare professionals and others. And so what we would likely be looking at, and you might have some good ideas, we're working on it, but to establish who a designated caregiver is. There are designated caregiver statuses that exist in law, and so that may be it. But it's the deciding agency is DEED, and there is an application process that can be affirmed or denied, and there is an appeal process that's in place as well if your claim for leave is denied. So the structure is there, and we've worked with the agency to get language in place that is very clear about who the oversight agency is.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, so that leads me to the next question. So I've been on the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council basically since I was first elected, so quite some time, got elected with you, Madam Chair. And the cost to employers is approximately $1.4 billion for unemployment. And that's like now. That's like with a record low unemployment. It's just shy of $1.4 billion, which is a big price tag. And you know, I'm trying to get my mind around, first of all, you have to figure out the definition of who qualifies for the benefit, which we don't know. But even if we make it so incredibly narrow as like unemployment insurance where, okay, I mean, it's not narrow, but it's the fact that very few people are on unemployment right now because we have record low employment, it's still $1.4 billion a year, and that's a lot of money. Just in February alone, it was just for the first week of February, it was $27 million that went into the trust fund. And right now it's $1.4 billion also in the trust fund. So we're talking about an awful lot of money. And again, that's with almost record unemployment. We have really, really low unemployment. There have been years where it's much, much higher. So it's really hard for me, you know, even though I've served on this Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council for almost 7 years and know how well that does run. It's one of the best run agencies in the state of Minnesota, and it's actually nationally known. They do a really great job, but it's a lot of money. And I can envision this as being even bigger than unemployment. I mean, depending on how you define what family is, right? So my confusion is in your testimony, though, you said something about, well, if you have a high-risk pregnancy and you have medical needs that are very narrow, but then when I read the bill, it's not narrow, it's depending on how you define family, it could be very, very big as far as who's getting the benefit. And maybe I misunderstood your characterization of, like, who would actually receive the benefit. But I have a lot of concerns with the scope, and it really comes down to how do you define a family member and who's going to receive the benefit. It could be more than $1 billion in a year of cost to the business. And, you know, we had several businesses, including, well, we had counties, we had cities come and say that this is a challenge for them, especially since they already have something in place, which apparently wasn't accounted for in the bill. So there are many, many issues that really needs to be worked out, and I have really great concerns. So I don't know if you have a comment to that, but this has got a long ways to go before it's anywhere near unemployment insurance, because that's run so well in Minnesota.
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad that we picked the right organization, the right program to model this legislation after with unemployment insurance. It's spelled out in the bill that if you are going to leave to care for a family member with a serious medical condition is defined to mean a physical or mental condition that involves inpatient care in a hospital, continuing treatment by a health care provider, and in order to receive the benefits, an application must be written from a qualified health care professional. So you can't claim a hangnail, and Minnesota workers wouldn't, to take 12 weeks off. In addition, with pregnancy, and that's when you get the potential to have a 12-week and 12-week leave, that leave also has to be certified by a healthcare professional. A worker can take leave that is associated with incapacity due to pregnancy, with miscarriage, or to receive prenatal care such as bed rest. The bill also allows workers to take leave in order to address their own serious health conditions. Like the other types of leave, applicants have to provide a written certification from their health care provider. None of these other than pregnancy are stackable. So if you have an illness after you give birth and have to physically recover from a complex pregnancy, that could happen. But as I said, may it never happen. It certainly is rare but not unheard of. Workers can also take safety leave, and if they need to receive medical attention, counseling, legal services if they are victims of domestic abuse or assault. The other piece of the leave that's defined in the bill is extingency, which authorizes paid leave benefits for workers when a member of their family is called to active duty military in the armed forces, and the workers need to attend to those family needs. So it is defined in the bill just what leave is, and I think that that's an important clarification.
Mr. Chair, members, she left, but I will just also add that there's also a 7-day qualifying period, so that anybody who is, this is the piece of the bill that is helped designed to sort of differentiate what kinds of needs are covered under this program as opposed to the regular PTO sick leave that most workers or some workers get through their employer. So the 7-day qualifying event means that for the first 7 days there's an assumption that, you know, some other form of support would work for that employee. And that also really has a big impact on the family caregiving part of the program in particular, because many workers take time to care for their family members intermittently over the course of a year or something like that, and often don't reach that 7-day threshold. So just to put that out there as well, that's sort of, again, to mm-hmm. kind of make the leave benefits under this program for those more serious situations.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many more names do we have on the list?
There are 4 names on the list, including you.
Go ahead, Nat. Okay, I'll go. Chair Halverson, I'm looking at Keith Carlson's slides, and the one question that pops up, and I think was mentioned by a few other testifiers as well, is I guess this would pertain to public employees, county employees. Employees should be required to take paid leave first. Any thoughts on that?
Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. I think that conflating paid time off for vacation or for a short-term illness misses the point of the bill. This is really about serious long-term circumstances that a family might face. I think that paid time off is very important for and covers most of our circumstances that we face. You know, if you're going to get the flu, if your kid's going to have the flu, that's going to be a short-term illness. It's not going to meet that seven-day threshold. It's not going to require you to take an extended time away from your job. And so conflating the two, I think, is concerning and problematic.
Thank you.
And as it is now 3 minutes to five, we will go into recess to the call of the chair. We will not return any earlier than 6:30. Members, watch your email and the public.
How many people are left on the list?
Three.
Do you think that we can get through the are people willing to stay another 15 minutes?
I am.
Let's come back.
Let's stay. I vote to stay.
I think we need to recess.
Okay.
Are there any questions? Who's on that list? Who's on that list? Swazinski, not here. O'Driscoll, not here. Gruffalo, what do you got?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're just looking around. Do we got the votes here? Do we?
No, you don't.
Not quite.
I was gaveled in.
So, well, first of all, I guess there's not a lot of members of the majority party to hear this, but, you know, I hope you don't mind if I just do a little teaching here for members, Madam Chair. But when your chair tells you just take another 15 minutes and extend the hearing, listen to your chair, okay? Someone smarter than me once said that good decision-making comes from experience, and experience comes from bad decision-making. You know, she's been around here. She kind of knows this place. And so if the minority party needs another 10 minutes to finish things up instead of dragging the nonpartisan staff and other people back here, you know, maybe you just listen to your chair and do what she says next time. Just a thought. And I'm sure you'll sometimes I can deliver a harsher message to the opposite party than the chair can, but hopefully some members of your caucus realize that and learn from that. So, because what happens is, now that we get dragged back here, now I feel like, now I want to get my money's worth, right, Madam Chair? You know this. This is all, right? If we're going to get brought back here and people want a show, then let's put on a good show for them.
No, let's not.
But Mr. Chairman, you know this already, and I'm not saying anything you disagree with, but maybe people just, it's a good life lesson to listen to the chair that when she says to come, you know, let's wrap it up in 10 or 15 minutes, that maybe they should do that. Just a thought, so. Madam Chair, just a couple of questions for you. First of all, is in the bill, there's the 12 weeks is where we're at. What happens in the 13th week?
Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo. Well,
right ahead.
Yes.
Right ahead,
I guess I would have to, I need more information about what the question is.
So,
would you like to clarify your question?
Sure, Mr. Chairman and Representative Halverson. So right now there's a 12 weeks of paid leave, if I understand it right, a nod will work. What happens in the 13th week? Once a person, under your bill, it becomes law, someone uses up their 12 weeks, what happens in the 13th week?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, that those decisions would happen with the individual and the employer.
So, Mr. Chairman, to the Representative Halverson, so it would not be a fair statement then to characterize this bill as saying that you don't care what happens to a person in their 13th week or any member who supports this bill. It wouldn't be fair to say that we're ignoring those who need these services in their 13th week. That would not be a fair statement, correct?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I think one of the things that's really important to note when we talk about the length of time is that most people don't take 12 weeks. Most people that this time frame is chosen for a very specific reason, and that is what balance happens that people are finding that they need in terms of time off and how much they can take because it is a partial wage replacement. So it's based on the studies from the university that says this is what people are asking for and needing, and the professor might have more information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pardon?
Briefly.
Well, I think it's also just important to note that the beginning part of the process is that an employee has to get certification from a healthcare provider about the length of time that they would be eligible to take these benefits. So it isn't just the choice of the employee. It's a process of a healthcare provider certifying that the person needs that time to be away from work to heal or to care for a family member. There's codes and there's well-established time frames for different types of illnesses in the market now. So anyway, it isn't just the worker who says, I want 12 weeks. It is a process, unless it's a bonding leave. In that case, the worker, you know, is making that decision.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, to the testifiers, I understand that part, but my point is that upon the completion of the 12 weeks under, if this bill were to become law, on the 13th week, a person, regardless of their condition, is no longer eligible for this benefit set or this insurance program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, there are circumstances where a person, it depends on the circumstances, but if a person needs additional leave in the following year, they can certainly take that as well. So
Mr. Chairman and Representative Halverson, so I listened to the majority of the committee hearing, and if at any point I ask a question that might have been answered when the hearing dropped, just tell me we answered that before, and I'm happy to go try to find the tape or follow with you later. But earlier in the testimony, you had said that going beyond the 12 weeks was exceptionally rare, that there was, well, these situations of where someone would have 24 weeks, that was, you know, I think the term used was exceptionally rare, if I remember right. So I just want to be clear. If someone uses up these 12 weeks, in their 13th week, there's no benefit, there's no that can be offered except in those narrow bands that were outlined earlier.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not understanding the question very well, but I will say that you're right. Taking the situation of 24 weeks is, from experience of other states and from the outline of this bill, something that would be exceptionally rare. If people also have options to take other types of paid time off that their employers offer.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Halverson, do you have any, you know, right now there are private sector businesses and private sector jobs that offer short-term disability benefits right now. Are you concerned about the job losses that may occur among those industries?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, the bill expressly states that any employer who wants to offer their own benefits can do so, including by building a program through short-term disability.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson, but that's current law, isn't it?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, yes, and we continue that option for employers.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman and Representative Halverson, why does this program have to be compulsory? Why are you forcing employees and employers into it?
Oh, that's a softball. Go ahead.
This is not about forcing anybody into anything. It is about making sure that we enable Minnesota employers to provide this kind of benefit for employees that most employers, frankly, can't. If most employers could, we would see greater uptake, because the ones who have demonstrated and stated numerous times that it's a market differentiator. When you're trying to get employers, it's a market differentiator to be able to provide this kind of benefit to your employees. We heard from numerous small businesses today, and I've talked to them other days, where they don't have the option. They don't have the economy of scale to provide this. At the same time, we know that there are Minnesotans who need the benefit. They need to take time off to have a healthy pregnancy. They need to take the time to take care of a newborn baby. They need to take the time to be with a loved one who is ailing. And so it's about empowering all employers to be able to provide this. And the ones that already do and love what they're providing to their employees and their employees love it as well can opt out of the program and provide their own own set of benefits.
So long as they match these benefits, correct?
So long as they're comparable, yeah.
Thank you. Groffalo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Halverson. So again,
Representative Groffalo, before you continue, the pain is getting to the point that you've got about five more minutes of this ping pong.
It'll be less than 5 minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Groffalo.
So just to be clear, though, the only opt-out for this is for the private sector employee and the private sector employer to agree to the mandate that you're imposing. That's the only opt-out. If an employer and an employee want to opt out of the Winkler Care bill, then they're going to they don't have a choice. The only thing they can do is meet the requirements of the mandate in this bill.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, if you need to, if you want to not be part of the state program, you can absolutely provide your own program. If you feel like you have a better market differentiation to attract employees, you can offer your own benefit you agree to, you can opt out.
So I'm going to jump in here because I have a question here, and I'm the chair. So if that employee and employer decide that they want to pay 100% of their salary, they can structure that, and it would meet the threshold of being better than your bill.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's true. And some employees do offer, some employers do offer benefits that are richer than what we're asking for.
Representative Groffalo.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson, so what is the fee they have to pay when they do that?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Groffalo, we have an administrative fee that is 5% of what they would have paid in. So the calculation ends up being, pennies per employee.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson, my understanding is you adopted the amendment that removed the cap on how much the assessment can increase in a year. Is that correct, or was I mistaken?
Mr. Chair and Representative, and we can, get clarification from Mr. Weeks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Groffalo, there was a maximum increase of 0.1% in a given year, which was taken out, a maximum increase or maximum decrease. They're still undefined, they're still blank in the bill, but there's a cap on the top the taxes can be and a minimum the taxes can be still in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Weeks, thank you very much. Two questions. Representative Halverson, since the November forecast, we are $400 million below forecast in revenues, and that is exclusively coming out of income tax revenues. That's where the shortage is. The economy is growing, unemployment is going down, but income tax revenues are falling up massively short. My theory is that one of the reasons this is happening is because rich people are fleeing the state and we have employer burden. We're increasing the burden on employers. Why do you think it's happening?
Mr. Chair, it's one of the things that's very clear when you look at economic data from the National Department of Labor is that productivity continues to grow rapidly in this country, and in the state of Minnesota, we tend to be more productive than the rest of the country. But wages remain flat or fall, and that certainly has an impact on revenues.
Representative Garofalo, one more.
Yep. So,
because you said one more.
Yep. That's fair. But I do think it's a question that the DFL majority needs to ponder: is the economy is growing, unemployment's going down, and income tax revenues are coming up massively short. And this isn't just happening in Minnesota. It's also happening in New York, and it's happening in Oregon. It's happening in other high-tax states. Now, whether people want to blame Mark Dayton's tax increases or the Donald Trump tax bill that capped the state and local tax deduction at $10,000, I don't really care. But it's happening. And this problem ain't going away, and adding an employer mandate to it won't help. Final question. This bill lists victims of domestic violence as being a qualifying condition to be eligible for these benefits. Can you explain the burden of proof that is required? Is there a criminal conviction? Is there a criminal charge? If a victim, whether they're male or female, if they make the allegation and then rescind the allegation, does that eliminate That is a qualifying condition. Does there have to be an adjudication in court? What is that legal standard that is determined whether a male or female is actually a victim of domestic violence? And, Mr. Chairman, thanks for your latitude. I appreciate you treating me as well as I treated you the last 4 years.
You want a beer, too?
Would it be better if we had Mr. Weeks? Or
I have the language I can refer to.
Go right ahead.
If you would like. It certainly is becoming more and more common for employers to recognize that employees have extenuating circumstances where they need to be safe in their residence, in their workplace, and that they need to use work time in order to deal with issues regarding their own personal safety if they're in a domestic abuse situation. And so you can take this leave if you need to deal with the court proceedings, if you need to deal with health issues that have arisen, if you need to deal with other if you need to deal with other legal issues. And the certification for an applicant taking safety leave is sufficient if it includes a court record or documentation signed by a volunteer or employee of victim services organization. So if you get if you get help from a domestic violence resource center like Tubman, that would also serve to prove that you need those services. You can also get this documentation from an attorney or a police officer or another person who might counsel on family violence issues. The commissioner must not require disclosure of the details relating to their abuse or assault. That's private and personal, and we're not asking for that type of information, but there is a number of ways a victim can get help and certification.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of a question, kind of moving back to kind of the premium idea. You talked a little bit about that this is a benefit that would follow the employee. Mm-hmm. So if they change jobs, they have multiple jobs throughout the year. How exactly, you know, is there a breakout in how that's paid between an employee and in the employer, or is it all paid by the employer?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, that's a great question. The way the author's amendment reads is that the employer who has the ability to do withholding in their computer systems would pay the premium and could charge back up to 50% of that premium to the employee.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how does the situation work? So let's say you have an individual who, because it's following the employee, is actually between jobs, and this is kind of being modeled around unemployment insurance. So if they're unemployed, they're getting unemployment insurance, but is this only when they're under current employment that they can actually receive this benefit, or is this a benefit that could follow them even when they're out so that they could simply, you get what I'm saying.
I get what you're saying. It's late. So
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll let the professor add some details, but you can, this benefit, because you pay for it while you're working, you can actually take it while you're, if you're unemployed. Very often people find themselves unemployed because of situations like illness, and they're not able to work. And so this is something that can follow them beyond the workplace in certain circumstances.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, employees qualify based on a certain amount of attachment to the workforce. Once they've met that standard in the last year, then they are eligible to receive benefits based on their earnings over the course of that year. In the UI situation, if somebody is unemployed, let's say, and then they have a caregiving situation that arises that doesn't allow them to continue to look for work, for example, or they have an illness so they can't look for work, right? So the basic requirement of UI is that you have to be eligible, you have to be willing to work and looking for work. So if those kinds of situations arose where you couldn't, then you could look to this program. But again, you would have had to meet that minimum kind of attachment to the workforce over the course of the prior year to qualify.
And then, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Yes. And to the testifier, thank you. So unemployment works, okay, I'm unemployed, then you always have an employment group come to the employer to kind of rectify to change potential rates. Is there any of that that happens within the system? So if you're, let's say you have a high frequency of use, and because the employer's in charge of 100% of it and has an opportunity to charge back 50%, how does that situation work?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is not an experience-rated program like UI. The idea is that we wouldn't want to penalize employers if they have workers who need to take advantage of this kind of a program. In fact, the idea is exactly the opposite, right, that we don't want the current system in many ways penalizes employers who have more employees that need to take these kinds of leaves, right, because every employer is kind of on their own to figure out how to manage these leaves and to pay for the benefits while they're on leave. So this kind of program, again, everybody's paying into this fund. It's a set. The premium rate is established for all employers and workers based on what the needs are of the entire state fund to keep it solvent. But there's no charge back. There's no penalty to individual employers based on the number of workers that are associated with them that take the leave or take the benefit.
How many more you got?
Maybe one or two.
How about one?
Three.
How about one?
Five.
How about one?
Six.
All right, Madam, Mr. Chair, so just a question on path. What's the future path for this bill as far as what committees will it be coming? Will it be coming in front of the tax committee, I'd imagine?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, yes, it will see the tax committee. The next committee stop is government operations. There is rulemaking in the bill. It will then, it'll see the light of day in Representative Mahoney's committee and taxes. We're doing the long hearing here, sir.
I'm just telling you, Representative Halverson, if you bring my committee to a night committee meeting, you're
not
buying the pizza.
Not on that committee.
I don't care. I am. And it won't be cheap pizza.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe in cheap pizza.
Good, good, good. Representative Tice, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Chair Halverson. I just have a couple questions. If an employee does qualify and takes the 12 weeks and then comes back in week 13 and says, oh, this isn't going to work for me, I'm going to quit, is there any type of, what do I want to call it? I don't want to say penalty, but is there anything that the employer recoups because they kept the job open? I mean, I'm just really worried about that part of it.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, that's a good question. Of course, this is modeled to follow the employee, so employee makes the investment throughout the employee's work history, and that's where the attachment point is. Do you have anything to add on that?
No, I mean, I think that the research shows that actually this increases the number of people that come back to jobs after these kinds of leaves. So that's, I guess, all I can say is that in the states with programs like this, it's actually had the kind of opposite effect than the way the world works now, is that employees tend to come back to their employer more when they're a part of these kinds of programs.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Halverson, I guess I'm really concerned about owner flexibility. My husband and I have a small inspection company where Greg is one of the inspectors and our son is an inspector, and then our neighbor is Greg's part-time assistant. You know, we don't have any reason to do this. Greg's had a disability policy for years, and I know Greg has talked to our son about that as well, and Amy probably doesn't care. So would I'd still have to pay the fee, or would I have to invest in it because we choose to opt out, but yet we already have some things in place?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, you're right. You have those options in front of you. It's paid family leave is different than the other types of leave that mm-hmm. people take. And so this would be, again, a long-term leave for illness to take care of a family member, other things. So it's not always a disability. It's for those circumstances that other leaves kind of haven't worked for Minnesotans.
I just, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Chair Halverson, I guess I am just really concerned about what this does to folks like us that have just a couple employees. We do what we can for our son. He's newer to the company. We've only had him there for a year, but Amy is not. But yet, you know, this is what she's doing since her husband thought she had to get a job when their last kid went to college. So, you know, she necessarily isn't that person that's looking for the benefits. And there's a lot of companies that do that. And when I look at, you know, what I got to pay in for, you know, tax liabilities, I mean, it's $3,000 a month. Now what am I going to be paying? It's a lot. Plus now I have to pay $150 per employee that does any radon work testing, and plus all the continuing education. So I look at all the costs that are coming up, plus they drive a lot, and we might have a gas tax. So I'm going to be paying more all the way around. And I mean, you know, it's a lot to think about, and a lot of folks like us look at it like, why do I want to do this anymore? And that's why we got out of the remodeling company, why we closed that in 2014. It's the reason I came here is because there's so much government telling me how to run my business, and I got to pay for it. And then I got to fill out a lot of paperwork, which is a lot. It's a lot to ask of our folks. And so it's a great idea, but I think if a company is small and really does not want to do it, I wish the opt-out meant just that, opt-out, because, you know, we've been taking care of ourselves for years and years and years, and it's mostly just Greg. Granted, our son is new, but we've had employees for, we had employees for many, many years, 7 to 8 of them, and we bust our butt to make sure that they were taken care of, and we did. Even when one of them's wife had breast cancer and, you know, different deaths in the family, we always took care of that and let them know that we were going to do the best that we could. And yes, it is a great idea, but there are also people that, experience shows me that there are people who will take a 12-week leave, come back, and quit. And it's just really a hard sell sometimes. I mean, there's all kinds of people out there, and they'll promise you things, and then they don't deliver, and it's really hard to get rid of. We need the workers, and that's a really big thing that we hear in the workforce right now is, quite frankly, I mean, we have issues in with PCAs and nurses trying to get people to come into work, and not everybody is a good person, and that is a concern for mine as well is, you know, what about some of the nursing homes that have to get rid of people because they aren't doing their job, and we've been hearing about it in committees, and it's really hard and it's really sad, and those are the things that I really worry about is what's going to happen to a lot of these businesses where our choice of workforce is very limited. We all know that, and so you're just looking for bodies to do the work. And sometimes there are issues that come with that, unintended consequences. So I realize this is a good deal, but I wish we had more options for more flexibilities for folks who have the really small companies. I mean, I don't consider 3 people a big, or 2.5 a big company. And even though I'm an owner, I don't get paid because that's one of the choices we made. To make the business profitable in the first year while we're training a new inspector and doing all the work, getting them set up. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we do as business owners that put ourselves to the nth degree. I'm the last one to get a paycheck. I'm the last one to cash it. I still have one on my desk because I want to make sure my employees get everything. And just, you know, I don't want to make it sound like sometimes we get really hard on you, but it is really hard. It's really hard sometimes to deal with these issues, and I'm just asking for not as much government. But, you know, I trust you. I know you'll do the best job that you can. I just wish we had a bigger opt-out for really small companies. I think that would be really beneficial. Thank you.
There didn't seem to be a question, but
there's Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you for the feedback, Representative, and thank you for your kind words, and I'll keep working.
And I would like to add, you know, you're a great, sounds like you're a great employer. Mm-hmm. She really does. And I appreciate that in this world. And some of the employers that I've worked for purposely tell you to go ahead and do that, knowing that it violates OSHA laws, and they don't care one bit. And if you're a first-year apprentice, I walked into a room about half this size that was just full of white flakes, and it was asbestos. And that was a small employer, too. Congratulations for being such a great employer, but there's so many others that are not. I have one question, and then we'll open it up for comments and finish this up. The UI, if you misuse UI, there's a clawback on getting the money back. Is there any such thing in this particular bill? So if you take advantage or swindle, other than going to court.
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm going to let the professor answer.
Yeah, there is some language in the bill now, but we are working with Deed to clarify repayment language in the bill for those situations where either there is some fraud or whether it's unintentional. Sometimes there's overpayment situations, things like that. So we are working on getting some additional detail in the bill on that front.
I hope you have it by the time you get to the unemployment.
We will, sir.
Representative Haley, how much longer are we going to keep the pain going?
Not much.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. And this may be up to Chair Halverson or the professor. I'm curious to know if you, in looking at, you know, how to do this, again, I appreciate the intent, but did you find any other models, tax credits, for example? I know you're trying to incent businesses to do the right thing and incent businesses to take care of their employees when they can. Was there any other study looking at different ways of doing it other than, I guess, what's to me is a universal one-size-fits-all mandate?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, for the visual, this is the study that the University of Minnesota produced. So there is really good data that Ms. Fitzpatrick looked into, so she can speak to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for this study, we were looking at different models that would achieve universal coverage, and we did consider a workers' comp kind of approach. That is what New York State does, for example. They require, it's an employer mandate. They can meet the mandate by offering self-insuring, buying a private insurance product, or by buying into a state product, basically. So that's one other model. Largely, we're looking at the models that other states have adopted, and other states have not taken those other approaches. So the point of this study was to really look at if we, Minnesota, were to go down the path of other states, what would that imply about, you know, what have we learned from those states? What do we learn from, you know, how those are working and what that, how that maps onto Minnesota's infrastructure? There are other studies that have looked at tax credits in other contexts. There aren't really tax credits. There's new federal tax credits in this arena. They're relatively new, so I don't think there's been a lot of data yet on kind of what the impact has been on those. There is research in other contexts that shows that it tends to not increase the offerings. It tends to help the people, the businesses that are currently providing. But again, child care tax credits for employers that set up in-house child care centers was one of those, for example. What they found, the research found there, that is, it just helped support businesses that were already doing it. It didn't tend to have the impact of increasing the number of businesses that were doing that. So I think the question is, what is your goal with the policy? And if your goal is to create some kind of universal-ish access, broad-based access, the tax credit approach, you know, probably wouldn't necessarily get you there. I know other proposals have been savings accounts, and again, there's a lot of work in the healthcare arena, whether those health savings accounts have worked to incentivize people, and there's a lot, you know, some mixed results there, so I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Representative Taylor, did you have another question?
I guess my concern is that an unintended consequence could be that employers reduce their hiring or limit their hiring again because of an additional mandate on them. And particularly in rural Minnesota, small businesses are our lifeline. And that would be, you know, very detrimental if they look at policies where they just can't do it anymore. And then we start artificially limiting hiring because of mandates. So just something to think about, I guess.
And Mr. Chair,
any further comments?
To that point, I also would love to point to another study from the University of Minnesota that shows that the need in greater Minnesota for these benefits is actually greater. The population is older. Younger people who are in the workforce are much more likely to have very young children. There are counties in Minnesota where 90% of the women in the workforce have children under six. And yet there's much less access because these employers tend to be smaller. They have less revenue, fewer employees. And so much more than incentivizing, we are trying to empower and give employers the tools that they have to meet the needs of the people that they're working with. I think the smaller the business, the more that their family, or that their actual family, as in your case, Representative Tice. And so I would just state that is the goal and the need in greater Minnesota. The concern for greater Minnesota is a big deal, and it's recognized in terms of the data.
Seeing no other questions. Representative Halverson, did you have any final short comments?
I will say it is it's a good bill. I really appreciate the debate. I appreciate people staying long. I think understanding this is going to be extremely important for all of us, and working through what the challenges are that still exist is an important goal to me. The biggest thing I want to leave everybody with is we have heard from people who are lucky. We have heard from people whose employers do the right thing, whether or not they have the resources to do it. We heard from the employer who had to forego paying her own mortgage so that she could support her employee. And we've heard from people who are employed by large employers, and our large employers in Minnesota are providing these kinds of benefits. But luck doesn't make for healthy babies. Luck doesn't make for healthy pregnancies. Luck doesn't allow us to be with our loved ones when they're ill. And we need more than luck to be the kind of Minnesota workplace that we want to be. So just ask for your support, members, and thank you again for your time.
So the author renews her motion to re-refer House File 5 as amended to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
Your bill is on its way.
Thank you.
Is there any more business before the committee? Any more business before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.